Good morning, everybody. Apologize for the delay this morning, but we're still getting back into the swing of getting started at 8 a.m. I wanted to just mention that there's going to be a little bit of an agenda change, and I should, for the record, say that this is opening the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources to information hearings today. We're hearing on a lot of important issues, reports to the legislature, and some new issues that we'll be potentially looking at next session. Some of the updates we're going to hear today are ongoing topics that we've been hearing about now for quite a while. We are a slight change in the agenda. We're first going to hear from the Water Resources Department, the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and then we'll have a big chunk of the morning on toxics and hear about an issue that this committee will be looking at more in depth on copper, reducing copper and brake pads, and then also looking at our toxics policy for water in the state. First, I'm going to invite up Phil Ward, the Director of the Water Resources Department, and Brenda Bateman. Thank you for accommodating the agenda change. You have about 10 minutes.
Okay, Madam Chair, members.
Good morning.
We'll be quick. Thank you. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, with me today is our leader in this integrated water resources strategy effort, Dr. Brenda Bateman. So we just want to give you a couple little updates this morning because you all gave us this modest assignment during the last legislative session to develop an integrated water resources strategy for the state of Oregon. Here's the things we'd like to talk about quickly today. Again, just a couple notes on background. Then we want to spend a little time on the people who have been participating with us in this effort. And Brenda will talk about then the activities related to that and where we're going from here. You will recall, members, that House Bill 3369, which was enacted last session, directed us to undertake the development of an integrated strategy for managing Oregon's water resources in the years ahead and meeting Oregon's water needs. And we have, under the direction of this legislation, attempted to do this. The bill requires us to find a way to both understand and meet Oregon's water needs in the years ahead. It directs our department to lead this effort, but It establishes a very firm partnership with DEQ, ODF&W, ODA, and a number of other agencies. And I have to say, for the record, that we have greatly appreciated the efforts of these other agencies, and DEQ has been a particularly strong partner in this effort. And then last, just some of the things that the bill requires. It requires us to consider climate change as we develop this strategy, land use trends, and population trends. So here to me is kind of an interesting piece of the equation. This effort has been very well attended and participated in by quite a number of different types of groups and individuals. Four departments and commissions and boards in the basic piece. We have an 18-member policy advisory group that represents just about everyone that you could imagine in the water world, from tribal governments to stakeholders and interest groups to local governments. We've had tremendously good participation from our policy advisory group. Then Brenda has pulled together a 15-member state agency advisory group. These folks are not receiving any compensation, their agencies, for their participation here. But we've had great participation from 15 different state agencies who have stepped in to help us in this process. And then recently formed has been a 10-member federal liaison group. And so we're working now with 10 federal agencies in this effort as well. And then numerous partners, open house sponsors, facilitators, reviewers, and just folks interested in this particular effort. We've had great participation. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Brenda, and she'll take you the rest of the way through.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator for the Water Resources Department. And the bulk of our efforts during this past year has really been spent on public outreach. We have held 12 open houses, 11 of them face-to-face around the state and one of them online. From that, we garnered almost 80 survey results from Oregonians. We've also held more than 30 stakeholder workshops with many types of groups throughout the state. And all told, in these events, we believe we've reached more than 1,000 participants. The results from those events are online on our project page, and you can get to that through the Water Resource Department homepage. It's a more than 40-page document that includes all of the results that we've collected, all of that information from these events. And we wanted to share with you just some of those highlights this morning. Very simply, we asked three questions of participants in these events. First, we asked them for their vision, looking into the future related to water in Oregon. Then we asked them for the challenges they believe their communities are facing related to water. And finally, and related to that, of course, the solutions or the things they'd like us to address first. Just a few examples or samplings of the vision results that we got. These really fell into two categories. First of all, folks offered up their vision of the physical water resource, so things like fishable, drinkable, swimmable, that sort of approach. But then they also offered up ideas related to process, that this be a balanced process, that basin focus really remain part of this, and regional partnerships, that this would be a science-based discussion, that we'd have less talk and more action. So we really heard two types of visions coming from these groups, and this tracks very closely with how our Water Resource Commission and Policy Advisory Group have been talking as well. They then offered up some challenges that they see in their communities. You can see that some of the bullets in here, climate change, population growth, and others, were specifically called out in House Bill 3369, but there are some others on this list that were new and original to these groups. We were struck as we met with Oregonians on this topic, whether they were high school students, water professionals, or members of the public, how thoughtful their comments were and how well-schooled they really were in some of their water challenges. What struck me as one of the most interesting pieces of information were the solutions that people offered, and we grouped those into 16 broad categories. These are roughly ranked. The number one item on here, groundwater-related solutions, means that we heard about this topic in more venues than any other topic. So we heard about groundwater and the need to tackle some solutions in that area in all 12 of our open houses and all 30 of our stakeholder workshops that came up the most often. But following right behind it, I'd say, were the next five items on this list. So water conservation and efficiency ranked very high as something we should be looking at. Water quality and public health, storage, allocation issues, and finally water reuse. Those really tended to travel as a pack. And then soon behind them on the list, you see the other items. So these are the kinds of things that Oregonians have asked us to place our investments and efforts in over the next months and years. Next steps, there's a lot more detail, of course, than what we've shown on these slides this morning. We'll be bringing all of our information results to our policy advisory group. They have the unenviable task now of paring down some of these items and prioritizing where we're going to focus next. Their job is to help us craft recommended actions, and that's what will land in the final strategy. Also this fall, you'll see a new set of issue papers released, and those will be available for public comment. We're trying to hone the problem statement and the statement of why we should be looking at these issues. As we move into the new year, we'll have a progress report due to the Oregon legislature in February. We're supposed to talk about what we've done so far and evaluate whether we think we can produce a strategy by 2012. Those recommended actions that I talked about will be in draft form in 2011, and we'll go back to Oregon communities and stakeholder groups and begin to review and vet those recommended actions with them. So there will be another opportunity, formal opportunity, for public comment in 2011 as we start to set some of these ideas down on paper. So those are the things that are coming up for us in this project, and we're happy to take questions at this time.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions to start with, and then we'll open up to the rest of the committee members. First, I just wanted to ask about the interaction with the survey that was done, I think it was 2 years ago, that was done as part of the analysis. I think you had hired HDR to do that. So looking at projects and needs throughout the state, was that 2007 or 2005?
I believe that was 2007.
Okay. So could you talk about the integration of that information in this process? Because that's more the technical piece you know, this is looking at what the, obviously we're looking at what the vision and long-term goals are, but I want to know how that technical piece is informing, helping inform this part of the decision or vision as well.
Do you want to start?
Sure. Madam Chair, the work that HDR did for the department a couple of years ago fell into two categories. One was some demand forecasting, and we've used that information as part of our background issue papers and baseline. That is to say, these are some numbers that have been projected, and these are what demands might look like in the future in the absence of, say, new conservation policies or new projects and components that might affect that water demand. So we use that as sort of a baseline view. To talk to folks about what demand might look like and then ask the question, and so how can we get that demand down? What are some policies and projects we can put in place there? The second piece that they did was to take an inventory of possible conservation projects. We really faced some reluctance from water users as part of that project, not really wanting to show their hand and talk too much about projects that might occur in the future. So we gleaned from that there's a lot more work to be done in that area, that there's some great possibility both with agricultural users and municipal users, but we would really have to place some more effort in that area to grow the possible conservation projects and portfolios.
Was it just conservation? I thought storage as well.
The third piece, which was not done by HDR, Madam Chair, but which our staff completed themselves, was a comprehensive inventory of storage opportunities for the years ahead in the state of Oregon, both above ground, so your traditional style of above ground storage reservoir, but also below ground. And we did something that I'm not sure has been done anywhere else in the nation. We categorized the entire state as to the opportunities there, the applicability of aquifer recharge region by region. And so we have essentially a map now which says, if you're interested in recharging an aquifer, this is the geology that's most suited to that, and this is where that geology is located. And interestingly enough, in the Umatilla Basin, where you all have chosen to invest some monies in a pretty cutting-edge aquifer recharge project there, that is some of the best geology in the nation to do this kind of work. So we are encouraged by that, Madam Chair. But we do have that now, that inventory, both above ground and below ground opportunities for storage as well. And that, all this information then, we believe, will fit very neatly into the ultimate strategy as it's developed. So if there are, particularly in local areas, if storage opportunities are high on the list, and we can identify where those best opportunities are.
And was there any prioritization process done as part of that, or was that done by the local communities, or was more of just an inventory of what the needs were?
That first step was just an inventory, but we would see that prioritization work occurring locally in consultation with technical staff. And so what we would hope then ultimately is that where there's the interest moving forward in some of this work, be it conservation projects, big new reuse projects, or storage projects, that the local community would really help drive that and make those prioritization decisions.
Okay. All right, thank you. Other questions at all? No? Okay, and if you can make sure that we all know when the next policy, technical advisory committee policy group meets. I know you've been sending those out, but just to make sure that all the committee members get that, if they'd like to attend or send staff to that, that would be helpful. I appreciate the hard work that you all have been doing and look forward to the next reporting, and thank you for keeping this process moving forward, especially given that it's been, I know, a challenging time with the budget situation. So I think it's really important, though, because even though obviously we are in a budget crunch, we still need to be preparing for the future of our water resources in the state, make sure we're using those wisely, and certainly given the challenges that we have, making sure that we're using our resources efficiently to deliver the services as well.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. We agree.
Thank you. Thank you. And for those just joining us, we did have a little bit of a switch in the agenda, so obviously we heard the integrated water resources strategy first, and now we're moving back to the copper brake pads. We do have, actually, all of our speakers are via phone, is that right?
They are.
This is our virtual part of the agenda. So we're going to get started with, I'm going to introduce this topic a little bit, and then we're going to hear first from the Mr. Stacy Sullivan, who's from California, the Brake Pad Partnership. Committee members, I want to let you know this is an issue that we're going to be working on during the upcoming session. I'm looking at this to propose as a committee bill. And this is an issue that came to my attention because a colleague of mine in the state of Washington was working on this and heard a presentation about the impact of copper on our streams and rivers, and especially in the Northwest where we have salmon in our streams. Are we actually going to see the video?
Not today.
Okay, so we're going to hear from NOAA a little bit later from the Marine Fisheries Service about the impact on copper on salmon. And also, this bill, a similar bill, legislation, is sitting on the governor's desk in the state of California, waiting for signature. We hope it's going to be signed. We don't know yet. But so this is certainly something that the West Coast is very interested in, West Coast states, and looking at. So I thought it would be prudent for us to look at what both California and Washington has been doing and seeing if it's something that we want to model after either of those states or come up with our own approach. And so we're going to hear both from the state of California and Washington today, along with from the Marine Fisheries Service. So first we have Stacy Sullivan on the phone. Are you there, Mr. Sullivan?
Should I hang up, Cindy?
Yeah. Hey, we're having a little technical challenges, but we'll be there in a minute. He's the policy director with Mr. Stace, Mr. Sullivan. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. It just sounds like he just hung up on us.
I think Cindy is
dead. We don't need to have a speakerphone on here or something.
No, it should be.
Hello?
Says the call ended.
Okay.
Are you going to try again?
No, it sounded like he actually hung up that time.
Yeah. Good morning. Mr. Sullivan?
Hello? What's going on?
I don't know. Can we call him?
Do you want me to try from up here?
Yes.
All right, let me try that.
Okay, we'll try a little bit. So much for advanced technology, but bear with us.
Hey, Cindy. Janelle, come here, please. So I just put the number in, do I hit send? Let's see if this works. We're quick.
We keep her running.
I know.
She hates these weeks.
Poor woman.
Thank you, Janelle. We'll see if this works. It says hold. Why is it on hold?
But I think if you push that, it puts it on hold.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Got it.
Don't touch it.
Don't touch it. Sure.
Good morning, Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is State Senator Jackie Dingfelder. Thank you very much for joining our Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and we apologize for the technical challenges we've had this morning.
That's quite all right.
Great. I've given a little bit of introduction. If you could introduce yourself and provide, you're the first speaker, so if you can provide some background on this issue, that would be very helpful. We're going to be hearing from the state of Washington next, and finally from a representative from NOAA Fisheries.
Okay, very good. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Stacy Sullivan. I am the Policy Director for Sustainable Conservation, which is a environmental nonprofit organization based in San Francisco, whose mission is to find environmental solutions that make economic sense. Our principal focus is in working in collaboration with the private sector to achieve these goals, We have been involved in a wide range of issues in that context. The background, such as it is, that I can give is that we were the moderator of the what we call the BreakPad Partnership, which was a coalition of stormwater agencies, urban stormwater agencies, environmental organizations, and friction material manufacturers that came together over 15 years ago originally to address the issue of dissolved copper in urban waterways. There were some early attempts at legislation back in the early 90s, actually, which were not really based on any kind of science, but they created sufficient interest to try to figure out, well, what are the answers to this, and where does the copper come from? What are the principal sources, and how can it best be addressed? The Brake Manufacturing Council, which was the group at that point in the trade group of brake manufacturers, prior to the beginning of the research, committed that to basically develop materials that would reduce copper in brake pads if the science indicated that automobile or vehicle brakes were in fact the principal or the primary source of dissolved copper in the urban waterways. We found funding from the state of California, also from some industry sources and foundations, and forward with a series of studies in the San Francisco Bay Area to basically answer the questions, you know, how much copper is there, what and where is it coming from? And the studies were completed in 2007. They're all available for reference on our website, which is www.suscon.org. And they were all peer-reviewed, and they all arrived at the conclusion that vehicle brakes were, in fact, the source of up to half, and in some cases more than half, of the total dissolved copper load in these urban waterways. At the same time this was going on, there was litigation in Southern California brought by environmental organizations to compel the State Water Board to deal with the issue of dissolved copper. And as a result of that, along with some other forces as well, the regional water boards in San Diego and in Los Angeles issued copper total maximum daily load requirements for the Los Angeles River, Biona Creek in West Los Angeles, and Choyas Creek in the San Diego Bay Area, and basically required them to have like 90% or approximately 90% reductions in the amount of dissolved copper no later than 2028. Well, you know, that it's one of those things where 2028, depending on your perspective, can sound like it's quite some time away. But when you think about the process that is required in order to one, either try to treat copper once it's already in the water or try to deal with it at the source, it's actually not all that long. And I'm sure the representative from NOAA would speak to this as well, but one of the things we discovered in the course of our studies was the volatility of dissolved copper of copper once it gets into the water, and also just sort of reiterating the extreme difficulty, I mean, in a sense, effectively practical impossibility of being able to treat water once it's already been polluted with copper. Requires huge amounts of money, effectively what would be condemning large amounts of land in urban settings in order to create settling to filtration systems and what have you. It is not an exaggeration to say that it would have cost both San Diego and Los Angeles over $1 billion each to be able to take that course with no guarantee that it would have worked. So on one hand we have these TMDLs, and on the other hand we have this science sort of showing us that vehicles are in fact the principal source. The studies were completed in 2007. At that point, the BrakePad partnership determined, sort of figured, well, what's the best way to approach this? Tried to see if a voluntary approach with the industry would work. That didn't really turn out to be very fruitful. So the determination was made, driven as much by the industry representatives on the partnership as by anyone, to pursue legislation in the California legislature. The industry's interest in that was basically they wanted to create a situation so that there was what they refer to constantly as a level playing field, that have a situation where good actors would not wind up putting themselves at a disadvantage to less scrupulous manufacturers offshore who might issue counterfeit materials or undercut the market or whatever. So the SB 346, our bill, was introduced in early 2009. The author was Senator Christine Kehoe from San Diego, who had a vested interest in the outcome, given that her city was one of the ones that kind of had a target painted on it, on the TMDL issue. And then the legislative process began. When we started out, we did not have the support of large portions of the vehicle industry, both manufacturers of brakes and but manufacturers of vehicles. In fact, we had rather strenuous opposition. One of the issues that arose down here in California was the existence of our Green Chemistry Initiative, which was passed in 2008 and is supposed to create sort of an overarching mechanism for dealing with materials in terms of analyzing less hazardous alternatives and trying to get away from a sort of material-by-material legislation. However, copper brake pads was different from anything else. One, the fact that we had already done all the scientific work. Also, that we had the compulsion, if you will, of the TMDLs. So the California bill, and then, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. We introduced the bill, got through the state Senate in 2009, but we still were facing a great deal of opposition that led us to make it a two-year bill. Late 2009, we learned that the state of Washington was planning legislation, and Rob Duff will be able to tell you much more about that. But this fact, along with others, basically broke the ice with some of the folks on the industry side. And so starting in January, we began to have much more fruitful discussions with the Alliance for Automobile Manufacturers and other trade organizations. But we were faced with this. With the Washington bill passed, this is the difference between having a part-time legislature with a 60-day session and having a full-time legislature in California, where by the standards of California, the Washington bill passed in a blink of an eye. And so it was there. We were faced with a difficulty because the Washington bill, because Washington was not facing the TMDL issue, there was no hard deadline in the bill to get down to a de minimis amount of copper. And that was probably one of the most difficult issues that we had to deal with in our negotiation.
So, Mr. Sullivan, yes. we're unfortunately running a little behind, so I might ask you to speed it up, and so we have time for a couple of questions.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that the final bill that we passed in California calls for a reduction to 5% copper by weight in material sold for new vehicles, both replacement and original equipment in 2021. This tracks with the Washington bill. And then a further reduction to de minimis 0.5% level by 2025. We figure that we needed that 3 years in order to basically more or less flush out the system, if you will, to allow the municipalities to be able to make a legitimate case that they would be able to meet their TMDLs.
And can you tell us what the final vote on that bill was in both the House and Senate?
It was vote was 70-3 in the state assembly and 30-6 in the state Senate.
Okay. And this, my understanding, is sitting on the governor's desk right now?
That is correct.
And do you have a sense of if he's planning to sign that?
We have received very positive indications. The fact that we don't have any opposition, and that we have support from both industry and environmental groups and urban stormwater agencies. We've had several promising meetings with policy staff in the governor's office, and so we're feeling, I don't want to jinx anything, but we're feeling fairly confident.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that summary. I'm going to open it up for questions before we move on to we're actually going to hear from NOAA Fisheries so we can hear a little bit more about the problem. Questions for Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you.
No. I really appreciate, apologize about the being a little behind schedule. Appreciate all the hard work that you've done. I know that we're going to have more questions as we work on this, looking at both the California and the Washington proposals, certainly about the timelines and how that's going to work. I expect that we'll be calling you to get updates, and my staff will be working on this. So certainly appreciate the hard work and the groundwork that you all have been doing for many years, and looking forward to hearing about, hopefully this will be signed in the next, week or so, and certainly looking forward to hearing more about how that goes and as we move forward on this. So I really appreciate you guys doing a lot of the groundwork, and we'll be looking seriously at it, looking at this as a committee bill for my committee.
Very good. I'd be happy to help in any way I can.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. So the, since this is a virtual part of our committee hearing here, we're going to now call. Do you want to call the NOAA? Is it safer for you to call? Okay. So next we're going to hear from.
We got the certified smart.
David Baldwin, who is a PhD research biologist with NOAA Fisheries. Mr. Baldwin?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I be heard okay?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Actually, I have to lower you a little bit.
Okay, so I won't talk quite so long.
Okay, good morning. This is State Senator Jackie Dingfelder. We really appreciate you joining us this morning for the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Just to let you know, we briefly heard from the California coalition that's been working on this brake pad issue. We would like for you to provide a little bit of background about why we should be concerned about this and what are the impacts of copper in our waterways. So we were hoping you can provide that background for us. And I will let you know we're running a little bit behind schedule, so if you can be succinct, and we'll try to hold our questions until the end.
Okay.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee. So I think I heard my name is David Baldwin. I'm a research zoologist for NOAA Fisheries up at the Seattle at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. I work in the Environmental Conservation Division, and the focus of our research has been contaminants. One of the focuses on the effects of contaminants on the biology of fish. Copper has been one of those contaminants because it's ubiquitous throughout the Pacific Northwest and represents an important class of contaminants, which is to say the metals. And you've probably already heard plenty about brake pads being a source of copper into the environment, so I won't go into that.
Well, actually, it would be good because we talked more about just the policy and not so much the science, so it would be helpful.
Okay, so just very briefly, one of the sources for copper entering the environment is brake dust, the dust that comes off of the brake pads every time a car applies the brakes. And so that ends up on the road. as a fine dust, and then when it rains, gets washed into the water, and then it can dissolve into the water and become an issue as far as exposure to aquatic animals, such as salmon, that are in the water. That's, to be succinct, I'll keep it to that and move on, unless somebody has a question beyond that.
Nope, keep going.
Okay. So salmon, as I said, have been a focus of much of our research, being at NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, in part due to the listing under the Endangered Species Act, but also because they're socially and economically important, obviously, to the region. One of our focuses has been the olfactory system of salmon, and that's been for several reasons. One is that it's important to many of the behaviors that salmon need to do in order to survive and reproduce, and that's including avoiding finding food, avoiding predators, and you know, what they're known for, which is the navigating back to their home stream in order to spawn. So the sense of smell is quite important for most of those behaviors. And others even. It's a highly sensitive sensory system, so they're able to detect very, very minute quantities of these odors. It's sensory system is directly exposed to the environment. In order to do its job, the nose has to be, you know, in the water, and therefore it's exposed directly to the contaminants. So there's nothing protecting the nose, in a sense, from these dissolved contaminants in the water. And then finally, the activity of the nose, the response of the nose to odors, can be measured in the lab, so we can sort of assess how well the nose is functioning. And I'll talk a bit about that when I sort of give a very quick summary of some of the findings that we've had. So I don't know what you have in the way of materials, and I might give this with a few slides, so I'm going to do my best without that. So.
Yeah, we don't, but it would be helpful when after this call, if you could send any PowerPoint, or I'd heard that there was a video that you had, if you could email that to my committee staff, we'll make sure and get it out to all
okay,
the members.
If you can give me a contact, yeah. Or if somebody can give me a contact, maybe Beth.
Yeah.
I've been in contact with Beth Petrino.
Yeah. Yes, Beth will follow up with you.
Okay.
She's our committee staff.
She has access to some. I just wasn't sure whether any of it was... there is a movie that is there, but it's best done with a bit of narration.
Okay.
Or reading a paragraph that comes with it.
Okay.
One or the other. It, by itself, it's sort of not very explanatory. Okay, anyway, it's a very quick summary of some of the findings we've had. So these are short-term exposure to low copper. By short-term, this is as low as little as 30 minutes in studies we've done. And by low copper, as low as 2 to 5 micrograms per liter, which is certainly within the range that might be coming off the roads and entering streams, particularly in urban environments where there are a lot of cars. So those are when I'm talking about copper exposures, that's what I'm referring to, is it doesn't take a very long time and it doesn't take necessarily much copper. So three main things, as far as findings, one is that it reduces the responsiveness of the sensitivity of the olfactory system to odors. So one way to think about that is that the same concentration of an odor produces less activity in the olfactory system. And this is how you measure it. We can actually measure the amount, the response, how much activity is elicited by an odor. And if you compare a fish that has been exposed to copper versus to one that hasn't, exposed fish will have less response, less activity to the same concentration of an odor. This includes an alarm odor. So there's an odor that we're not quite sure what it is exactly, but it's an important cue to salmon that predators are present in the environment. It's released following an attack on a salmon, and other salmon will detect this odor, and it serves as a cue that there's a predator present and the fact that the area has become dangerous. That reduced ability to detect an alarm odor, and this is where the movie would come in, affects that response. So salmon have an alarm response. So when they detect, when they feel that there's a predator in the environment, they'll stop whatever behavior they're doing, such as, say, feeding, and freeze. And they'll stop swimming around, and they'll sort of slowly settle towards the bottom of wherever they are of the stream. And this is because a lot of their predators are very visually motivated, and so if they see something move, they'll target that. So if you're a juvenile salmon in a stream feeding, the last thing you want to be doing is moving around and continue feeding if there's a heron there looking down, looking for dinner. And so they have this alarm response. If there's a, if they think there's a predator present or if there's a cue, they'll freeze and stop swimming around. And what we found was that if you take fish that have been exposed to copper and you add this alarm odor to the water, they don't freeze. They continue swimming around, as opposed to fish that have not been exposed to copper. If you introduce the same amount of this odor, they'll stop, they'll freeze, they'll stop swimming. Now this isn't in a tank, and the movie shows it pretty clearly. It's in a 10-gallon tank. There are actually no predators present. It's just it's an innate behavior by the salmon that's pretty clear. It's easy to measure whether they freeze or not when you introduce the odor. And so what we've gotten is new data now to from a graduate student at University of Washington we're working with that shows that this alarm response, this freezing that's produced by the odor, does actually reduce the risk of an attack by a predator. So what she did is she actually had predatory fish in the tank with juvenile salmon. And when the odor was introduced, the juvenile salmon froze if they had not been exposed to copper. If they had been exposed to copper, the juvenile salmon did not freeze, which is what we saw in the lab, in the small tanks. And more importantly, the predators more quickly homed in on the moving salmon that had been exposed to copper and attacked them much faster. So there was an increased risk of being attacked by a predator because you had failed to react to this alarm odor.
Okay. Ms. Braun, we're going to have to wrap up here because we're running out of time. So I have a quick question about the impact of copper break the impact of copper dust from the brake pads. Do you have any sense? And I don't know if you this might be more of a question for the Department of Ecology next. Of what percentage of the copper is coming from brake pads versus other sources?
What I couldn't answer is for particularly for Oregon. I couldn't answer for say Portland. What we know is we've got some evidence. I'll let Department of Ecology talk to it. They've got some harder data.
Okay.
But it's a substantial percentage, at least as they've estimated down in California.
Okay.
The exact number, I don't have to. I wouldn't be willing to say right off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you, and Beth Petrino will be following up with you so we can get a copy of that video and slides so my members can take a look at it. Other questions for Noah? Honest? No? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Baldwin. We appreciate it. I know it's a little bit of a rush here, but it sets the stage for what the issue is, and that's very helpful. And then we'll probably be following up with some additional questions.
Yeah. Beth has my email, so if there are, she can get a hold of me.
Excellent.
Feel free to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, so next and last, well, we're going to hear from the Department of Ecology up in Washington, and then we're going to briefly hear from one of the manufacturing members that worked on this issue both in Washington and California, correct? That will provide us with a industry perspective. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Mr. Duff. This is State Senator Jackie Dingfelder. Thank you. We apologize for running a little late. You are on speakerphone, just so you know, on the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. We've already heard from Mr. Sullivan from the Sustainable Conservation, the coalition working in California, and we've also heard from Mr. Baldwin, the zoologist with NOAA Fisheries. So you're sort of providing the wrap-up as far as what's happened in Washington, and then finally we're going to hear from one of the industry representatives.
Okay, and how quick would you like me to make it?
5 minutes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Sure. So my thanks to the chair and the committee. My name's Rob Duff, and I manage the Environmental Assessment Program for the Washington State Department of Ecology, and that program is basically the science arm of the agency. So I'm going to give a quick background. I'll try to avoid things that I think Stacy and David have already covered, and then I'll do sort of a wrap-up on how we might implement our new law on reducing copper and brake pads. So the agency, the Department of Ecology, has a reducing toxics initiative, and there's a few thrusts in it. Key among them is stormwater. We also have a key thrust towards reducing persistent biocumulative toxics as well as products, and we have a recently passed Child Safe Products Act getting at that particular focus. Stormwater has been, and as you know, has been a significant problem across the country, really anywhere where there's developments or runoff. And so copper brake pads or copper issues and other issues in stormwater was of concern to the agency, particularly up here in the Northwest when we think about salmon toxicity. We have ample evidence that copper is toxic in both freshwater and marine environments. You've probably already heard from David how we're particularly concerned about salmon and their ability to avoid predation and find their home spawning stream, so I won't go into that. But that was basically why we even looked towards California and all the important work that they were doing to show that copper was a big contributor to stormwater, because we had these concerns up in Washington State. We also knew there were lots of stakeholders that were going to be involved in the process. Key among them are both the auto manufacturers and dealers, two separate stakeholder groups, as well as brake pad manufacturers and retailers, also separate. So it's important to note the players there. And then we had local environmental organization participation up here in Washington State, but no national organizations, although I think California did. So our basic approach to developing the bill was look at the body of work that California had done. They had spent years developing a model and estimating the load of copper into San Francisco Bay and showing that in urban environments up to 50% of the copper is coming from brake pads. So pretty good target there. You want to target your priority sources. So we felt confident that that was solid work they had done, and they had also drafted a bill and had gotten it, I believe, through one house last year, and so we had something to work with. So we started with the California bill, made changes, and started working with those stakeholders that I had mentioned from that draft. And one of the big issues that came up from the stakeholders were the dates. And it wasn't just the stakeholders about when we could actually start reducing levels of copper, but it was also legislators. We initially tried to move the dates up prior to 2021, where you heard about the hard ban at 5%. But the industry laid out lots of issues, both the brake pad industry and the auto industry, that they needed time to develop the alternatives and then also get them through the long process of going from drawing board of a car to actually showroom. So we immediately realized that 2021 at 5% really was the most feasible first tiered ban, and that was never an issue for the industry. They had already or always indicated that 2021 they could get down to 5%. What was an issue was the second date. When could we move to the more effective 0.5% ban? And as I said, that was both an issue for auto industry and legislators. We got a lot of eye rolling from our legislators and our key sponsors about these dates, because they're pushed so far back, and there was a lot of back and forth and explaining and attempts to change the dates and move them up. And that process basically for us started referring back to an experience we had with the ban of flame retardants in the state of Washington, where it was simple to get two formulations done, but there was similar concerns over safety and feasibility, that we set up what we called an off-ramp process or an advisory committee process. So do the easy stuff where there's
agreement on both sides of the issue, which would be the 2021 ban of 5%. But to get to the harder issue of 0.5%, we agreed that we would set up a committee process that was managed by the department to try to determine when we could actually go to 0.5%, and this is what we call our off-ramp process. And so that is in our law, and we're required to convene this advisory committee of experts from the industry and other sectors prior to 2015 to see when we can actually get to 0.5%. And I'm sure you've already heard that California was successful in getting a hard ban at 0.5%. So anyway, that is the basic guts of our bill. There were exemptions, as in the California bill, that we set up for original equipment manufacturers as well as aftermarket. And then there are other issues that are a little bit different than California in terms of how we are going to monitor whether the levels of copper go up and down, as whether some of the other constituents that we wouldn't like to see increase, like zinc, particularly. So we would like to monitor those levels. And then also, how do we ensure certification that these brake pads are what they say they are? And then we actually do have a process, I know California does, to address a particular concern about specialty vehicles or small vehicle manufacturers, that they can apply for exemptions. We didn't give them an outright exemption as we did for, you know, clearing stock prior to the ban or cars made prior to the ban. But we have a process where if there are specialty vehicles out there or small manufacturers where there won't be a big impact, then we do have a process for allowing exemptions. And another key thing for us is how are we going to implement? Our basic approach, and we had advice from our alleged director and our AG's office, that there's enough in here that we would need to do a rulemaking, and so we've defined a rulemaking process that will start next year to figure out certification. How do we stamp these things to show that they are what they are? How do we test? What test methods do we use, and how do we get the data from industry to make sure that, as I said, zinc and antimony and other constituents aren't increasing that we might be concerned about, and then also this special exemption process. So we will do a rulemaking for that, and as I said, we will have to convene that committee prior to 2015 to see if 0.5 is feasible, which with California's work, it now seems like maybe we'll get there when we convene that committee. So right now, our current status for implementation is we're working with a Society of Automotive Engineers. They have a brake materials environmental task force. They're already moving on a lot of the certification and monitoring and sampling methodology, so that we hope that they'll be ready when we start our rulemaking, and it'll be a fairly smooth rulemaking. We're also working with the California Department of Toxic Substance Control so that we're not duplicative of all of those things, how to certify, how to monitor, how to test. And as I said, after our 2011 legislative session is when we expect to start our rulemaking. And that pretty much wraps it up. I think the key differences, I'll just go over the key differences with the California bill, and I would encourage you to look at both bills, is that we both have the 2021 ban at 5%. California has a hard ban at 0.5% at 2025, so we still have to convene our committee to see if we can get there. And then they have an exemption process that looks a little bit broader than ours. And they also have a requirement for alternatives assessment, which is a key provision, I think, in their bill. So with that summary of what California did and understanding that Stacey's already talked, I'll leave it at that and take some questions if you so desire. Bye.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Duff. I appreciate it. Quick, can you tell us what the final votes were? Because we did hear in California and Washington, and if there was any opposition in the end on this bill.
I know that it passed fairly easily. The way the process went, Senator, was at first our bill had some issues, but we pushed it as is, and the industry testified in support all along, with the caveat that they're confident that the agency would be working with them to get to the end. So they're the industry and the local business associations were supportive but cautiously in testimony because this moved very fast. We had a short session last year. So there was always the caveat that we need to work with the agency from industry to get this bill fixed. And there was a lot of work done in the last few weeks, as you probably will hear from industry. So there, I think the support was always there, but there was always cautiously optimistic that we would come to agreement, and we ultimately did. There were some amendments that were turned down at the end, and I just don't remember the votes, but I know that they weren't incredibly close.
Okay, we have 40-6 in the Senate and 86-12 in the House.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Questions for Department of Ecology?
No.
Representative, okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Duff. We will certainly be, my staff will be contacting you with follow-up questions and information, and we really do appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to inform us about the Washington process. We have been looking at both bills, and we'll be looking at both pieces of legislation as we work to move forward here in Oregon.
You're welcome. I'm happy to help.
Great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And last but not least, we have somebody in person that's going to come up from the industry and talk to us. Thank you, Paul, for doing this sort of impromptu.
And being in person.
Yes, and I don't know if, also, I know this is not your group, but you may want to speak to the...
Happy to do so. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. That is the trade association for the world's largest auto manufacturers in the United States, Asia, and Europe. And we wholeheartedly support the Washington bill and have some issues with the California bill, although we did not oppose it, and I'd just like to lay out what the differences between the two bills are and why there are different circumstances in California that caused them to go to a slightly different direction. First of all, the Washington bill has in it a process to determine whether an alternative... Well, let me back up. Both bills have the 5% copper limit, as well as limits on other kinds of... Washington has limits on other kinds of constituents that is effective in 2021. And we're very comfortable with that because technologically, we know how to get there. We are working to get there. We know what the technology is to get to that point. We don't know how to make a 0.5% leap by 2025. California has a hard limit, but it has off-ramps that if we go to the agency in California and say, we're not there, the agency can back off. Washington has a goal with those same standards to try to reach it, which is the process we would prefer.
But it's not a hard deadline.
It's not a hard deadline. Because no one knows how to get there at this point.
And my understanding, and it was mentioned, that was driven by the TMDL issue in California.
It was very much. There were cities that had to show they had a plan that could be accomplished to meet certain limits, and if they didn't have a hard stop, even with off-ramps, they wouldn't be able to meet their requirements for the TMDL. So that's why we did not oppose the California bill, but in both cases, they're off-ramps. And if I could just very briefly tell you just sort of what they are, because these are the important factors. We as an industry, as well as all of us as consumers, obviously have a great interest in making sure that brakes work, that they do what they're intended to do. So that's obviously one of the critical factors in terms of determining whether there's an alternative is whether they actually meet federal safety standards. There's off-ramps both in the California legislation and Washington about the cost and quantity. It has to be a material that's available to meet the worldwide demand for automobiles. And then it has to be one that meets consumer expectations, in other words, that it works without the kind of noise and shuttering and durability problems that consumers expect us as an industry to meet. So they're very practical issues. Perhaps the other one that's also a very big concern is it has to be done with a material that is no worse for the environment than copper. Because obviously we all know that sometimes there are alternatives that are in fact worse than what we've done. So in Washington, we have a process where directors of the National Traffic Safety Administration, the Washington State Police, environmental groups, industry, brake manufacturers, all the interested parties, all the parties with knowledge, will get together starting in 2015 as convened by the Department of Ecology. If the department thinks there might be an alternative based on its research and its communication with other departments around the nation. And then that committee will review it, make advice to the department, and then the department, if it agrees with that advice, will do a rulemaking. We're comfortable with that process. There may be a different process that's slightly more efficient, and we've talked, Chair and I, about, of course, looming budget issues, and the Department of Environmental Quality's budget is not protected from those looming budget problems. So we may be able to find a more efficient process to do that, but we think that is the appropriate way to handle it, where we're looking at trying to find a technology that at the moment doesn't exist. We need to have people around helping us figure out, are we there yet? Can we move to the next step? So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. The letter that staff handed me is from the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association. You may have that in front of you. And it is the folks who make the brake pads that we install on our cars and light trucks. And its position is exactly as ours, that California was a special circumstance, needed a hard stop because of the TMDLs for several cities. We prefer the Washington legislation, and in fact, they and us can wholeheartedly support the Washington legislation. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Questions? Thank you, Paul. Before you leave, I just want to mention, first of all, I appreciate you coming up sort of impromptu, but I appreciate the work that's been done already. Certainly, we have no interest, and I hate to say this, in reinventing the wheel or the brake pad, so we want to make sure, we'll, as you hear, we'll be working very closely with our partners in Washington and California, but certainly, given our budget situation, too, we want to make sure coordinate with the work that's already been done, because obviously there's been a lot of groundwork on this. So we'll look forward to working with you and your stakeholders as we move forward with this. I appreciate your cooperation.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. So with that, we will move on to another but very related issue. And as you can see, there's been a lot of work already done on the issue of copper in our waterways, but we're going to hear on a broader scale a report from the Department of Environmental Quality on Senate Bill 737, which was a bill that we passed two sessions ago to look at reducing persistent pollutants in our waterways. And so obviously this dovetails very well with the issue we just heard. This is on a broader scale. We're going to hear from Palmer Mason, who's the Department of Environmental Quality, and Jennifer Weigel, who's my constituent. Thank you for being here today. Palmer, you want to kick this off?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me today Jennifer Weigel, who is our Manager of Standards and Assessment at the Department of Environmental Quality, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk about Senate Bill 737. As the Chair indicated, this was a bill that was passed in the 2007 session, and DEQ has been working to implement that bill. And as our Director indicated yesterday at the House Committee meeting, we've had a great partnership with the cities and special districts and local governments on this effort, and so I wanted to make sure this committee knew that as well. I think if you boil it down, Senate Bill 737 has three parts, which Jennifer is going to cover in much more detail, but just to give you kind of the overview, one is the department was charged with developing a list of priority persistent pollutants. And again, Jennifer will talk about that some more, but these are the type of pollutants that once they're in the environment, they linger there, and they have a documented effect on wildlife, the environment, or human health, or all of those things. One of the other features of the bill was for the department to submit a report to the legislature on the sources and pathways and ways to address these persistent pollutants in the environment, and this is sources and pathways as it relates to surface water at large. So Jennifer will go into more detail about what that report describes and what kind of information we were able to offer the committee. And then lastly, the bill has another key component, and that is to work with the 52 largest wastewater treatment facilities in the state of Oregon and identifying whether any of the pollutants on this persistent list, priority pollutant list is are in their effluent, wastewater effluent, and if so, work with them on reduction plans to address those substances. So those are sort of the three key components of Senate Bill 737. And I just want to close by saying that reducing toxics is a priority for the Department of Environmental Quality, and 737 is only one way we're addressing that issue. We have work in air toxics, work in other areas as well. So I will stop and let Jennifer take it from there.
Thanks, Palmer. Jennifer?
Good morning. For the record, again, my name is Jennifer Weigel, and I manage the Water Quality Standards and Assessments Programs at the Department of Environmental Quality. And so what I'll do is I'll talk about a little bit more detail some of the areas in which we've been working to implement Senate Bill 737. As Palmer indicated, there's two major areas or two major requirements under the Senate bill that were incumbent upon DEQ to complete over the last couple of years. The first of that was development of a priority persistent pollutant list, and due to the tongue-twisting nature of that phrase, we've shortened it in a lot of our discussions to the P3 list. We completed that in June of 2009. Another major requirement for DEQ was to develop a report on the sources of those pollutants and identify potential opportunities for reduction, including things to be considered in prioritizing some of those reduction opportunities. We completed and submitted that report to both the House and Senate committees in June of 2010. The other major area, as Palmer mentioned, was the requirements for the municipalities to implement measures to reduce these pollutants if they find them above certain levels in their effluent. So key to that is sampling their effluent to determine at what levels these pollutants are occurring. Those efforts are going on right now, and the other looming deadline that this all feeds into is for those situations where they find pollutants above certain levels that they are required to develop reduction plans to address those pollutants to be submitted to DEQ by July of 2011. This slide here highlights just kind of the overall process that we've been under and also highlights kind of really, I think, how we characterize it as a transition from some of the requirements of the bill that are incumbent upon DEQ to complete. As I mentioned, the list itself, the legislative report, and then we also did a rulemaking earlier this year that established concentrations of those pollutants that we would measure the municipality's effluent against that would then determine the need for whether or not they needed to do plans and for what pollutant parameters they needed to address in those plans. So as I mentioned now, DEQ is collaborating closely with municipalities on conducting that effluent sampling, and we will be developing the conclusions and identifying for which pollutants those plans need to be developed over the coming approximately 9 months. A couple of other things I just wanted to highlight and again reiterate was, as Palmer mentioned, we have been working very closely with municipalities. This is an effort like this. We're not aware of any effort like this that has occurred anywhere else in the country, and particularly sampling 52 municipalities for the 118 pollutants that are on the list was no small feat. And we do want to acknowledge the effort and the coordination that's occurred between DEQ and the municipalities in carrying off that event. The other thing that I want to highlight is that throughout the products that we have developed and the efforts that we have ongoing, we want to acknowledge the assistance of both science advisory work groups who have been really key to us being able to put together the list and in providing scientific input on doing this, because, again, nobody else has quite approached this in a similar fashion. So we really were breaking new ground in terms of how we approach this program. And also we have had extensive opportunities and meetings and conversations with stakeholders in the public about this process throughout, and we continue to do so. And so now I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about the legislative report that we developed last spring in particular. as I mentioned, it was completed in June of 2010 and really had four major components to it that were requirements contained in the statute that were things that we needed to address within this report. The first being the pollutant list, which we had previously already developed, and the other three parts that were really kind of the bulk of the work that we had to do last spring in pulling this together was identifying what we thought the potential sources of those pollutants were, what we knew about these pollutants, how do they move through the environment, what are their chemical characteristics, and identifying measures to reduce the pollutants in Oregon's waters. And I just wanted to remind folks that this report was quite broad in nature and included consideration of all different kinds of pollutants and consideration of all different types of sources. So it was pretty broad and encompassing in nature. And just to review a little bit more in a little bit more detail some of what went into the report and what it contained, the priority persistent pollutant list, as I mentioned, it contains 118 pollutants on it. And the definition that was provided in the statute governing how we selected those pollutants identified that those pollutants needed to, as a baseline, be toxic, and then they needed to either demonstrate that they persisted or bioaccumulated in order to be included in this list. The kinds of things that are contained in this list, the kinds of pollutants that we have ultimately included, were things that spanned kind of almost any type of pollutant that you might think about. So, for example, personal care product ingredients. We have things on there like, things that might be considered antibacterial or have to do with fragrances and ingredients. Industrial chemicals and metals, flame retardants. There's a number of different flame retardants that were included. Pollutants that have either global sources or legacy sources, things that we've used in the past but continue to be cycled through the environment through runoff or erosion. Pesticides, there's a number of pesticides on the list, both urban use and agricultural use. And then there are also a number of other chemicals that were included that met our baseline criteria. In terms of sources that we identified in the report, again, there's a pretty large diversity in terms of the sources, potential sources that we identified as part of the report. But one thing that I wanted to highlight is that there really is a common thread to these potential sources, and that is that a lot of these things are associated with kind of the everyday activities that we as humans take on, whether it's, cleaning and household types of things, or whether it's, industrial manufacturing, or whether it's the types of vehicles we drive, or outdoor burning, things of those natures all contribute to the ways in which these pollutants could find their way into the surface waters of the state. And what we also did is that in identifying and leading up to identifying potential opportunities to reduce these pollutants, we did what we called pollutant profiles, where we compiled all the existing data that we could really find that highlighted kind of the characteristics of these things. So, for example, what are the potential uses of these things? Where do they start from? As you're all aware, this legislation had a significant focus on pollution prevention. And so figuring out where these pollutants originate from was really key to be able to identify what some potential opportunities to reduce them would be. Identifying what the potential pathways of these pollutants were also really key. Where might they be coming from? Do they start in the air, move to the land, and then run off? Are they directly deposited? Are they cycling through our environment? Are they coming out of discharge pipes from industries or other places? So part of this report was focused on what do we know about how they end up in our surface waters. And then we looked to find out whether or not there were data available that could help us figure out how much might be coming into our environment on an annual basis. If we had, this was a particular challenge because there's not a whole lot of information for a lot of these pollutant parameters on actually quantities that we could measure about what's actually going into the surface waters. Where those data weren't available, we looked to other different types of measures that could just give us a sense on a relative scale how much might be in our environment. So, for example, you know, how much of a certain chemical is being stored or used that ultimately we need to account for and ensure don't end up in the environment if we didn't have specific data on how much was entering our surface waters. And then also identifying any existing data that we were aware of that indicated the level or presence of these pollutants in our environment. So we looked to our own data, USGS data, and any other data that we were aware of that could highlight what we knew about these pollutants' presence in our environment. And as I mentioned earlier, this legislation has a particular focus on pollution prevention. So when we identified particular opportunities to reduce these measures, we ourselves placed a heavier emphasis on pollution prevention. And that is, of course, as you are aware, is really pollution prevention, meaning what can we do to prevent these pollutants from getting into our environment in the first place? And by and large, our conclusion is that pollution prevention does, in the majority of cases, prevent the most cost-effective opportunity to control these pollutants. Once they become in the environment and are more dilute, they are much more difficult to control and to minimize. That said, we did also identify other opportunities that we are aware of that really were more kind of end of pipe or treatment processes or other types of things that could also be used to minimize the release into the environment after these pollutants have been used. And also, as I mentioned, what we were charged to do and what the legislation asked us to do was to prioritize opportunities for reduction. Once we compiled all this information, we had 118 pollutants, and we compiled to the best of our ability all of this other information. And what we ended up doing was just highlighting on a relative scale some of the opportunities, the pollutants and their associated opportunities to reduce. And so we developed this little schematic that just showed, based on what we knew about their toxicological persistence and bioaccumulative properties, which one of these caused us high concern. And a lot of these pollutants we were able to group together. The flame retardants we could group together, industrial chemicals we could group together. And so we grouped these chemicals and said, as a group, which of these causes the most concern based on their properties? And also then looking at a spectrum with a preference toward pollution prevention types of activities and those that we think provided the greatest opportunity to be cost-effective, where did these things fall out on these two spectrums? And so obviously those pollutants that have the highest potential to cause harm but also have the greatest opportunities to reduce, we would place suggest that a higher priority be placed on those activities to address those groups of pollutants. And so at the end of it, we've compiled this report, and this report, as I mentioned, was broad in nature, so we think it presents probably several different opportunities to build upon the information that we compiled. Public education that might be taken on by DEQ, the municipalities who are charged with implementing part of this program, or even different types of non-governmental organizations or anybody else who's interested in getting the word out on some of these particular pollutant parameters about opportunities to reduce them. We think there is a link to some of the information that we've compiled and the charge to the municipalities to develop reduction measures in their pollutant reduction plans that are due in July. So we think that there is a connection there as well. And as Palmer mentioned, we've got several different ongoing activities related to toxics in addition to this program. Again, not reinventing the wheel, looking for opportunities to use this information that we've compiled that can help us in the strategy that the agency's working on and other different venues where we're looking at toxics. Now that we've completed the report, the focus of where the program is right now is on working closely with the municipalities on helping them know what they need to do in order to successfully complete their plans by the July 2011 date. We expect that those plans are going to have an heavy emphasis on public education and outreach to get to consumers about some of the products that they choose to use. Again, as I mentioned, the other key piece to this is the effluent sampling that's ongoing now, so we continue to provide assistance, and DEQ's own laboratory is doing the sample analysis for the municipalities. And so last but not least, I just wanted to close with noting that I think a lot of the work that we've done to date really provides a strong foundation for us to finish completing the requirements that are contained in the legislation. And I've highlighted here the website where we've where we have all of these documents posted, and where anybody can go to find additional information. So I'll pause there and ask if there are any additional questions.
Thank you, Jennifer. Questions? No. Quickly, I know that there's been the major focus has been on point sources, but can you talk about non-point source and when you're looking at source of pollutants, how you're deciding, you know, what the sources and if they're coming from non-point versus point sources? Obviously, the focus of Senate Bill 737 is on the municipal wastewater treatment plants and stormwater and other sort of municipal controlled end product there, but certainly we have non-point source both in urban and outside the urban areas, and so if you can talk a little bit about that and what the strategy is for looking at reduction those sources.
Mm-hmm. Chair Dingfelder, the first two pieces of the legislation's requirements for DEQ were to develop the list, of course, and then to do the report. Those two items were developed without regard to sources or narrowing the scope of those things related to sources. So the report itself contains a lot of information about where they might be coming from. And so things, for example, some of the things based on how they're used, we can infer how they might be reaching surface waters of our state. So, for example, predominantly, for example, urban pesticides may actually, we may not see them in the municipality's effluent, but we might see them in their stormwater, or we might see it in other types of things that reach roadways and then run off into surface waters. Similarly, for another pollutant on the list is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. So that has an air component to it, because a lot of those are byproducts of combustion. And so what you get when you have vehicles or fires is you get these PAHs that cycle up into the air and then they become deposited on the surface and then run off into surface waters. So that's the type of information that we've highlighted in the report, is how where these some of these pollutants originate and how they end up in surface waters. In many cases, in many cases, those are not coming out of a discrete pipe. In terms of how DEQ is looking to address those, that's where I think the bridges to our other programs become important. The specific requirements of the legislation are related to what's coming into the municipalities through their collection system and comes out after treatment through their pipe, and that's where the implementation of this is focused. But we are doing a number of other activities throughout the agency, including the agency's strategy. And where appropriate, some of the things that we've learned would be included or identified as potential priorities for the agency to be working on in the future.
Yeah, if I could, Chair Dingfelder, add to what Jennifer just said. I think that's an important point. She explained that when you look at 737 and you're looking at the list of pollutants, you're talking about wherever those pollutants come from, how they impact surface water, and that's not always a water source. It could be an air source or something else. And that makes Senate Bill 737 a very useful way to look at toxics. And we've taken that same approach with the agency's toxic reduction strategy, the agency-wide strategy, and expanded a little bit by saying for a defined list of toxics, and we have 53 individual toxics or chemicals or in chemical classes, for those 53 chemicals, where are all the sources, be they air, water, or land, and what are all the pathways, even if they don't move through water itself, where that particular chemical can be at a level of exposure that's either bad for the environment or bad for people. And so I think that's really important when you talk about these toxics. They don't respect little boxes about staying in air, staying in land, staying in water, and they also don't respect those boxes in terms of trying to manage toxics. It's, you know, the air program at DEQ can do what it can do, the water program can do what it can do, but they really need to work together because these chemicals, again, don't respect these little boxes. And so that's the logic behind our agency-wide strategy, is to say comprehensively where all these toxic chemicals come from, and what can we do more efficiently at the department by having these programs take an integrated approach.
Well, thank you for the presentation. We look forward to hearing more information as we move forward. And we'll be hearing, I think next time I'd like to invite the municipalities to come up as well and talk about, you know, how they're addressing and working with DEQ. I've recently been updated by the Association of Clean Water Agencies on how that's moving, but I think next time we'd like to have the partners can come up, because I think we're going to be that further along in the process, so we can hear a little bit about that from the municipal perspective. So with that, there aren't any other questions. We'll move on to the next issue. Palmer, did you want to stay up there to introduce? I don't know if you're going to introduce the
Are we going to do ballast water? Or
no.
Is that what we're doing?
We're doing truck, aren't we?
We're doing truck.
Okay. So, yeah, we're doing ballast water a little bit later. Okay. Thank you. So moving on quickly to our next issue. You guys, if you can do this in 10 minutes, we'll actually be back on schedule, so appreciate that. We're going to have an update. We had asked DEQ, if you recall last session, we tasked them to go off and work on truck efficiency and idling standards. So we're going to hear a little bit of an update on where that process is with DEQ. And with that, Andy, if you want to kick off, appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And with me is Kevin Downey, who is our Clean Diesel Program Coordinator. While Kevin's getting up the first slide, I'll just note that climate change is a pressing and serious issue. Warmer temperatures are leading to a decreased snowpack and reduced spring runoff and a variety of other effects that can impact Oregon's environment, economy, and people. And the slide illustrates the growth of greenhouse gas emissions that's projected as compared to the goals that the aspirational goals the legislature established in 2007. And DEQ is one of the agencies charged with helping to make progress towards those goals. Obviously, in these difficult economic times, we must be cautious about how we move forward in addressing greenhouse gases. But fortunately, there are a number of measures that will reduce greenhouse gases at the same time save energy and save money. So they have the potential to bring economic development to Oregon, and if carefully crafted, they're the types of measures that we can move forward with now to make progress on our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals while positioning Oregon for the future. During the 2009 session, DEQ Director Dick Peterson committed to several values as we move forward in exploring these measures. And one that's very important to him is an open and transparent process where we have extensive involvement from the public and from stakeholders and a lot of communication with legislators. Also, Dick has focused on having a great sensitivity to the economy and the state budget and using the best available science as we move forward. So as you mentioned, Chair Dinkfelder, today's focus is an update on truck efficiency and idling. I just want to really briefly mention there's a number of other greenhouse gas measures that DEQ is working on. They're illustrated in the slide. We don't have time to talk about them today. You've asked that we come back in February when there's more time on the agenda so we can get into those at that time. So I'll just mention that in pursuing all of these measures, we've really tried to live up to the values that Director Peterson established. We've had a number of major advisory committees where we've ensured that all views have been present. We've put together an outstanding website where people can track and sign up to follow our progress. We've developed white papers on the technical and policy issues. We've conducted extensive economic analyses. We got an EPA grant, and we were able to hire a contractor to help us with that. And we're conducting a number of public workshops and public hearings on all of these measures. So moving on to truck efficiency and idling, the purpose of this program is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while also saving fuel and therefore money at the same time. And the approach is essentially to improve the efficiency of long-haul trucks and also to reduce unnecessary idling from commercial vehicles. House Bill 2186 directed us to design a program and recommend legislation for your consideration, but I want to emphasize that DEQ does not have authority to implement the program we're going to describe to you today. It would require new statutory authority. You have a copy of the executive summary of our report in your materials. This report was developed in consultation with a study group that you can see illustrated on the slide here, which was a diverse group of stakeholders representing a variety of viewpoints. I want to emphasize that the report is DEQ's recommendation. We did take into account the comments received by the study group, but it does not represent their views. It's a DEQ report. The committee administrator has a copy of our full report if you'd like to look at it. So all of the meetings of the study group were open to the public. We had a set time at each meeting for the public to address the committee. We had a website where over 1,100 individuals subscribed. And because this program would save fuel, the idea is that it will pay for itself within a few years and actually begin saving truckers money. But the challenge is for truckers is to obtain financing on the front end, and also for equipment that would be needed to retrofit their trucks to receive to get these savings, but also to figure out a way to implement a program like this during a recession that makes sense. So a major part of our study focused on those questions as we were directed by House Bill 2186. We looked at the cost recovery through fuel savings and how quickly the payback would occur, and Kevin will illustrate that in a minute. We looked at a phased implementation so that the requirements would phase in over time, hopefully time with the recovery, and financial hardship exemptions, and then we looked at comparable requirements of other states and the EPA. So with that, I'd like to introduce Kevin to briefly run through what our findings were.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dick, fellow committee members. My name is Kevin Downing with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And what we're talking about here is the issue, as Andy has said, was greenhouse gases, which in the case of petroleum are directly tied to fuel consumption. But we could expect also reductions in other pollutants, air pollutants and toxics like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that my colleague had described to you just moments ago. And actually doing this through a mechanism of energy efficiency, which is actually regarded by many as a vast and low-cost energy resource for the United States. In this particular, we're focusing on trucks, and there's a range of trucks, medium and heavy-duty trucks consume a significant and increasing amount of fuel. In 2008, about 26% of all liquid petroleum fuels were used by medium and heavy-duty trucks. And since 1990, greenhouse gases have increased from trucking by 70% as compared to all light-duty vehicles, which increased over that time frame by about 14%, even at accounting for the switch in the light-duty market from sedans to pickups and SUVs. Not only that, but this rate is expected to continue. The Energy Information Administration projects that fuel consumption from trucks will increase in both absolute and percentage terms over the next 25 years. And so freight movement is an integrated process involving barge and rail as well as trucks, but trucks play a critical role within that as well because they're ubiquitous in every part of the freight movement chain. And within that, they move the majority of the high-value freight in this country. But not only, although rail and barge are more efficient on an energy basis in terms of freight movement, trucks still move the large majority of tonnage by freight as well in this country. As they say, if a truck brought it. That's certainly very true. And what we're seeing here in these numbers is actually a reflection of the movement to the just-in-time business model, where business managers have shifted their costs from maintaining inventory to putting product and goods on trucks and moving their product that way through the system. In terms of within the trucking realm itself, as I say, there's a large range of duty cycle and weight classes among trucks, but it's really among the Class 8, the so-called very heavy-duty long-haul trucks, where we see the greatest opportunity. They account for about 40% of the fleet of trucks, but consume nearly 80% of the total fuel consumed by all trucks. To give an example of this, from another perspective, in 2007, the Congress directed the National Academy of Sciences to develop a report evaluating fuel efficiency technologies for medium and heavy-duty trucks. They evaluated a number of strategies that involved both changes on the original manufacturer side, as well as strategies that could be employed onto existing vehicles, like, for instance, reducing aerodynamic drag and lowering rolling resistance. And what they concluded, and looking at a range of vehicle sizes and worked through the applications, they concluded that, and I'm quoting here, a given percentage reduction in this vehicle category, that is the long-haul truck category, will save more fuel than a matching percentage improvement in any other vehicle category. The potential fuel savings in tractor-trailer trucks represents about half of the total possible fuel savings in all categories of medium and heavy-duty vehicles. And as Andy suggested, too, about the return on investment, and that was actually one of the charges that was given to us. We looked at what the return would be to an operator that invested in some of the standard technologies that are available now in terms of reducing aerodynamic drag and improving rolling resistance. On this chart, what we have is actually various scenarios over various mileage. So on the horizontal axis, it's annual miles that the truck would travel under three different scenarios for fuel pricing at $2.50, $3, and $3.50 a gallon. And in this instance, we're also looking at a single tractor paired with three trailers, because oftentimes a trailer might be parked while it's being loaded, but the tractor continues to be in revenue service pulling other trailers. And you can see that for over-the-road trucks that may travel somewhere upwards of 100,000 miles a year, that even in this scenario, we're looking at the cost of a loan within this factor as well. There's a net positive return from investing in these technologies. So that this actually is a proposal that would actually pay back to the operator over time. We also did a simple payback calculation as well that suggested that the simple payback would be less than 2 years' time on a truck operating at 95,000 miles a year at about $2.50 a gallon. The current price for diesel fuel in Oregon is around $2.80 a gallon, which is up 30 cents a gallon from this time last year. What we're recommending is a program that would apply to that sector of the truck market that consumes the most fuel, that is the heavy-duty over-the-road trucks, and more specifically those pulling 53-foot box van and refrigerated trailers. And these would be traveling, the targeted for those traveling at those distances and speeds where the currently available technologies can maximize the environmental benefit and reduce the financial hardship to the owner. So what we're suggesting is that truck efficiency would apply to all heavy-duty tractors pulling 53-foot trailers, beginning with the 2016 model year and going forward, and then phasing in for model year 2015 and older tractors and trailers. This would, in many respects, mirror and actually, in fact, harmonize with the program that's underway in California right now that began with the 2011 model year vehicles. We'd be relying upon certified technology that has been demonstrated effective through programs like the EPA SmartWay program, which is an effort that the EPA has established to specify and certify current and emerging technologies to create efficient tractor-trailer combinations. Not only that, though, we'd exempt certain classes of tractors, trucks, that where this clearly would not work. For instance, what we're calling short-haul and local-haul and drayage tractors, that is, those that travel, say, less than 50,000 miles a year, those that travel no more than 100 miles from a point of dispatch, or those that service an intermodal or a port yard. We're also recommending that there be an opportunity for a deferral for those operators that are unable to obtain financing from this program. And, of course, then any program, any truck that is subject to the California requirements and meets those requirements will be compliant with our standards as well, because we're not interested in creating a distinct standard in Oregon. As Andy had mentioned, we're looking at a phasing-in schedule that allows people sufficient time to plan and act, but also potentially also move beyond the current economic difficulties that we experience ourselves in, so that, for instance, a large fleet could begin compliance in 2016 but would have until 2021 to complete the upgrade of their fleet, and small fleets would have a delayed starting point but have yet another year to be fully in compliance. The other matter that we looked at, too, was idling by vehicles. Idling is actually can be a significant source of fuel use as well as an impact to costs and emissions. There's two different sort of types of idling that occur. Typically, there's long-duration idling, which is that what we associated with truckers spending their nights or their mandated federal safety rest period in their trucks, operating the truck engine to maintain either heat or air conditioning, comfort in the cab, or to run small appliances they may have on board. This is actually a fairly inefficient use of this engine. Now, the estimates are that nationally that idling would consume about 670 million gallons of fuel a year at a cost over $1.8 billion. There's also another component of idling, which is actually the workday idling, which tend to occur in bits and pieces through the day as other trucks move through during their work cycle, but oftentimes it's sort of meant more for the operator convenience. The estimate there is that idling at that level may consume 1.9 billion gallons, which is about three times the volume from the long-duration idling, at a cost of about $5.4 billion. These are national numbers. We don't have Oregon numbers, but typically the Oregon consumption for diesel fuel is about 1.5% of the national consumption rate, and so that's about what we'd expect to see in Oregon. So there's 27 states that now have some form of idling restriction on the books, much less a variety of municipalities that also have some kind of restrictions on idling. Several years ago, EPA, seeing this issue about discrepancies among all these jurisdictions, convened a stakeholder group to develop a consensus model for and recommending that all states and jurisdictions moving forward would adopt a comparable program. The idea being is to ease compliance so that people know what the standard is, wherever it is that they're traveling, and that's what we're recommending that be adopted here as well. Fundamentally, what it is, it would apply to highway commercial vehicles. It would limit idling to 5 minutes in a 60-minute period, 30 minutes during a loading and unloading period. There would be various exemptions because we're not looking at eliminating idling. That's unreasonable to eliminate idling entirely, but there are moments when idling the engine is important. For instance, if there's an emergency or law enforcement situation, stopped in traffic, mechanical difficulties, power takeoff equipment that may be used by the vehicle, those would all be acknowledged and be part of the exemptions as well. We're also proposing a phase-in period on this for about 3 years, at which we commit to education outreach so that people can be clear about what the expectations are, and they also have time to accommodate. In many cases, there are available technologies that can be deployed on these vehicles that can cost-effectively meet the requirements that they needed to meet while they were idling the main truck engine, which, as I mentioned, was an efficient way of getting much of this kind of power. Let's see. So in closing, we wanted to say that what we're recommending here in both the truck efficiency and the idling piece acknowledges the differences in duty cycles or the whole range of the universe of heavy-duty and medium trucks that are out there, particularly in regards to fuel consumption. We're also providing sufficient notice to plan ahead, as well as options to act and to be in compliance with these requirements. We're looking with these recommendations to harmonize with comparable requirements elsewhere. We want to minimize the financial hardship, and we're also looking to secure the environmental benefit. Thanks very much for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you, and appreciate you going through that in a timely manner.
I took out all the verbs.
I noticed. Very efficient. A question about the idling standards in other states, and I heard you say that 27 other states have adopted. Do you know, in the Western, you know, looking at like the I-5 corridor or I-84, do you have a sense as our neighbors to the north and south and over in Idaho?
Chair Dingfeller.
You probably don't have the whole list.
Yeah. I know California. I'm not certain about Washington.
These are 40s.
Right, and the nearby quarters, no. Actually, I don't have that right at the tip of my fingers.
And the reason that the EPA has not, they've sort of said, we want to have consistent standards, but Congress obviously hasn't issued anything.
Well, they don't regard themselves as having the authority to establish a national idling law. So they took on the role of engaging the conversation that would hopefully result in, a national standard.
So, in other words, it would have to be passed by Congress if it was going to happen.
I assume, yes.
So we'll hold our breath on that. Okay. Any other questions? You have three questions.
Madam
so making
Chair,
up for...
Last time.
Yeah.
I've been saving.
Senator Boquist.
I've been banking it.
Yes.
I do appreciate the plan ahead portion here because our biennium, our revenue forecast, you know, is flat for up to 2016. So I think the problem of getting financing would be a real issue here. But I have a specific question. In regards to, do you have any data? I sit on the OSP work group, and so State Police work group. Any data at all, or where we might find data on idling and truck idling in terms of accidents and traffic jams? Like, is there a nationwide data, something we might be able to apply to the Portland metro areas and stuff like that? Because what we're trying to do is figure out when you have an accident. Obviously, all the trucks come to an idle. There's pollution put out for a couple hours. There's all kinds, but we're trying to find some sort of even empirical. Whatever we can find. So if you can get back with me on that. And the second question is, you had specific benchmarks of, you know, 5 minutes, 30 minutes, so on and so forth. How would you envision enforcing it?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, we'd imagine actually that most of this would actually be enforced on a complaint basis, and so we won't obviously have staffing to have an extensive network of people observing this, so we'd be looking at responding to complaints and taking action from there.
So,
and Senator Boquist, if I could add, Senator Dingfelder, that we would really be primarily focused on an education approach where we would, you know, we would have signs posted in locations where people idle, and that kind of outreach would be really the emphasis. But you're absolutely right, Senator Boquist, there would have to be some backup enforcement. It would be on an audit-type basis. As Kevin said, we wouldn't expect to have much, if any, staff to do that type of work.
Senator Brzozowski.
Yeah, to follow up on Senator Boquist, enforcement. Who's going to do the enforcement? I mean, if someone calls in a complaint, hey, there's a truck that's been idling for what? Are we going to send someone up from DEQ, or are we calling OSP, or what?
Well, Senator Brzezinski, there's a number of ways that could be handled, and that's one of the things that could be worked out through the legislation. At a minimum, DEQ would have authority to take enforcement, and typically in this type of scenario, we would issue a warning letter. We would provide people with information. If we had, for example, a fleet that was a repeat offender, it might get referred for formal enforcement. But it would be potentially possible for other agencies as well, but we'd have to explore, you know, how that would work under their authorities and statutes.
As a follow-up to that, can you just speak about the voluntary efforts that have been going on? Because I know that there's been truck stops throughout the state that have been working on, you know, having more plug-in availability. Can you maybe talk about that and how successful that's been?
Chair Dingfelder, so yes, we have been working with, actually, well, there's a number of companies now that are coming on the scene, and we've been successful in getting, well, at that high, we're at like 7 locations in the state that had electrified pedestals, and then unfortunately one company went out of business, although they've reorganized and they're coming back, but the two locations that they'd established in Oregon have not yet reopened. But that company that we has the other 5 locations in Oregon has actually moved their main office to Oregon. They've received a grant in Arizona and North Carolina, as well as part of a national grant to where they're now expanding locations to at least, well, I think the number might be in upwards of 50 sites across the country. And as I mentioned, there are other companies, and we're in conversation with them as well about bringing their technology into electrifying truck stops to provide the an alternative. And on that point, you know, we talk about using the energy over the grid. To characterize what the efficiencies are, even if we account for the energy, say, coming from a plant like Boardman and transporting electricity over the lines and all that, it's still 90% less energy in terms of a BTU kilowatt basis to provide power to the truck over the grid than it is to run the truck engine itself.
And as far as education, what has been done so far? Because I know there's been some outreach already, obviously, through this process. And I'm assuming, you know, the trucking industry has been working with their members to make sure they know that trying to reduce idling where possible. Can you just speak a little bit to that? And then I have one last question. I think Senator Boquist had one more.
I'm good. Okay. Thank you.
We've been talking with the Oregon Trucking Association about these kinds of measures. We haven't actually done a formal education campaign per se because we don't, at this point, we don't really have a standard that we can point to in the state. So it's, but something like this would help us actually convey the message more strongly, we think.
And that would clearly be our desire to partner with the associations and other agencies that have regular outreach to trucking fleets to do that type of education, but we haven't really done much yet, Senator Dingfelder.
Okay. One last question about idling for passenger vehicles. And have you looked at what the percentage of impact for I had a constituent ask me about this and say, why aren't you addressing passenger vehicle idling and education on that? And that's, you know, a whole other issue. But looking at, right now we're just focusing on the fleets and trucking industry, but we also have idling issues with passenger vehicles and trying to educate folks about that. Has there been any work at all done, do you know, nationally or other states, or was that factored in at all in your discussions in this work group?
Chair Dingfelder, the short answer is no. The I took a review of the idling laws that are out there, and I believe that there's only one or two out of that universe that actually address light-duty vehicles. Most of the regulations apply to commercial heavier vehicles, and so I don't have any numbers on the impact that comes from light-duty idling.
I would just add to that, Senator Dingfelder, we focus primarily on heavy-duty idling because of our emphasis on diesel particulate emissions, which is one of our most significant air toxics. That's not to say that motor passenger vehicle emissions aren't also of concern, but in terms of our agency focus, it's really been on diesel emissions.
And I guess one other question I had was about the geographic impact of idling, and I didn't see... I mean, I saw a lot of statistics, but not geographic statistics. Do you have sort of maps that show where the biggest impacts are? And the reason I'm thinking is, you know, like I-5 goes right, doesn't go through my district, but right through downtown Portland where we have a lot of congestion, and thinking about the impacts. We have an environmental justice group that looks at the impacts of contaminants on local communities, and I'm just curious if you've done any studies looking at, you know, where most of the idling is occurring, whether it's through congestion because trucks are sitting there waiting to get over the I-5 bridge, or through downtown Portland, or through, you know, areas of Salem or Eugene or whatever, or areas where we know that trucks are, you know, taking a break, and this is an area where they tend to overnight or be idling part of the time. I think geographically, and looking at based on the conversation that we had with your colleagues before looking at pollution prevention, I'm just curious about also the geographic impacts.
Right. Let's see. Let me think. So for long-duration idling, we haven't done a study looking at specific locations, but we're talking about idling over a range of things. The example that you gave about idling during congestion, which would be actually one of the exempt areas of, we wouldn't be enforcing for idling during traffic congestion. So... but otherwise, long-duration idling done by truckers would be done at locations where they tend to spend those long periods of time resting, which are not only at truck stops but also at distribution centers, waiting for the centers to open, for instance, or frankly, on off-ramps or rest areas, or what's widely known as wide spots in the road. So they can be in a variety of places around the state. Workday idling, of course, occurs typically where people are. So reducing idling in those kinds of circumstances, either for the people working around the vehicles themselves, much less residents in areas where that work is happening, would have benefits for their locations.
And Senator Dingfelder, your question gets at the fact that an idling program would not just reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also toxics and other pollutants. And one of the benefits of an approach like this is you do get multiple, you know, reductions in multiple types of pollutants from one approach. But we approach this whole issue with a climate change lens on, so we're really focused on the total amount of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's not really location sensitive, since it's a global issue. But with regard to air toxics, you're absolutely right. It does matter where the idling occurs, but we just haven't looked at that carefully.
I just happened to think about that as I was sitting on I-5 behind a number of trucks yesterday. I mean, it, the congestion component is a big component of idling. We don't expect folks to turn off their engines, but obviously congestion is a big part of the issue with idling. That is a whole other area that we need to address. But any other questions for this panel before we let them go? Senator Boquist, I only counted two, so you're banking one.
You got the idling police question.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it, and we'll look forward to hearing more about this during the next session. And we will be sending out to members the full report, because I know you're dying to read it. Thank you. Okay, now on to yet another topic, and we're almost on track here with time. I'm sorry to say that because we started late, we're going to forego our break. So I have a feeling you are all very capable of breaking on your own.
We're senators. We do that all the time.
Right. I was going to say it, but I was trying to
be politically correct,
which I appreciate why you're here, Senator Boquist. So with that, I had asked the Department of Fish and Wildlife to provide us an update on the Oregon Wolf Management Plan. We know that there's been some discussions going on with that, and so that's why I'd asked the department to be here today. We could spend hours and hours talking about this, I'm sure, but just wanted to provide an update to committee members of where we are on the statewide perspective on that. And certainly things have changed very much in the past few months, especially with the relisting the wolf. So if we can get that update. And I guess Kurt Melcher isn't here today.
Right.
Okay. So, gentlemen, if you want to introduce yourself and what your role is at ODF&W, that would be helpful. And thank you for being here today.
Not a problem. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Craig Ely, Northeast Regional Manager, and our lead on wolf issues at this point in time. This morning, we wanted to give you a brief overview of where we're at in our updates of the wolf management plan. It's been compounded with the recent federal decision to relist wolves for the whole state in Oregon, and how that is interplaying with us and what we can and can't do. And Craig will provide you with that overview.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Craig Ely, Northeast Regional Manager. We've provided you we call backgrounders of the current situation and a bit of history of wolf activity in the state of Oregon. The department receives a number of wolf reports almost on a daily basis. We do have two confirmed packs in the state of Oregon, and we do have some evidence of wolf activity in the Cascades. We also have wolf reports that come into us frequently on singles and pairs of wolves that are scattered throughout eastern Oregon. We have two packs that we have. We have 10 adults and 4 pups in the MNAHA pack. We have 4 radios collars deployed on those, one of which is not working. It's a GPS collar that is not functioning anymore. We monitor that pack up to 2 to 3 times per week so we can report locations to livestock producers that are interacting with that wolf pack and in the area. The second one is a Winaha pack. It has 4 adults and 3 pups, has 1 radio attached on an adult male, and we monitor that pack on a weekly basis. The current status of wolves in the state of Oregon is that they are both listed on the state and federal endangered species list. August 5th, a federal judge in Montana, relisted the wolf on the federal list so that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service really is the controlling entity for wolf activity in the state of Oregon. We provide a lot of assistance with them, but they are the ones that call the ball, if you will, on wolf activity and wolf management in the state of Oregon. I wanted to note that the federal ESA sets the minimum amount of protection, as I said earlier, and that there are some things in our Oregon Wolf Plan that are more liberal than what the federal protection in terms of control actions for wolves. We've had 2 depredation incidences in the state of Oregon, one in the Keating Valley that happened in 2009. Those 2 wolves killed a total of 30 livestock over 5 separate incidences. Landowners, we encouraged and met with landowners and implemented a number of non-lethal measures which were successful until the pair of wolves returned in August of 2009. We did have a radio collar attached to those wolves. Initially, when we were having the earlier depredation incidences, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was, again, calling wolf management issues in the state. And then when they were delisted by the federal government, Oregon's plan then took over in terms of directing wolf management. And when we had the second, when they returned in August of 2009, we had made a decision to lethally remove those animals, and we authorized Wildlife Services to do so, and they did so in about a week after we did that authorization. The second depredation event happened most recently. In May of 2010, we had 6 confirmed calves killed by wolves in the Wallowa Valley. Those animals, and again, we worked with landowners to implement a number of preventative measures to try to get those animals to stop depredating. I believe the last depredation occurred in late May, early June, and we do not have any knowledge of any depredation since that time. We issued, consistent with our plan, we issued Cotton the Act permits to landowners. Cotton the Act is defined in our plan as biting, wounding, and killing livestock. So you have to catch the wolf in the act. And we implemented, again, a number of non-lethal measures. One that's gotten a lot of publicity is the Range Rider program that's in place right now. We've had, again, no depredations since May, and that depredation, I will tell you, allowed us to look at the effectiveness of our plan document and how we could make some changes in it, because we're in a review period, which Ron will talk about in a moment. We made some significant, I think, changes to the document to try to make it better for us to move a little bit faster towards lethal control if needed or necessary when we're livestock owners are experiencing depredation. Funding for the wolf program is just under $500,000. We have three sources of funding that we are using to implement that program. We have approximately $209,000 that's in a state wildlife grant. That is a 50-50 match with the federal government. A 50% from the state comes from the state tax checkoff dollars. The next one is a PR grant. It's about $257,000, and that's a 75-25% split between the two, federal and state. And then we received a $15,000 grant, which is a 50-50 match, and we added $15,000 to that to implement the what they call the Wolf Livestock Demonstration Program. So that's the brief history of the funding.
So as part of the commission review of our wolf management plan, when it was originally adopted back in 2005, we were directed to come back in 2010 and to review the plan and make any necessary updates. And we're in the process of doing that right now. The plan goes in front of the commission in the end of this month. And hopefully at that point in time, based on the comments that we've received from the public, the meetings that we've held with the various user groups, and the changes that we've made, the commission will move forward with adoption of the revisions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And then, excuse me.
No, I have a question, but I'll wait until.
Okay. Yep. Just want to do a quick legislative history of where we've come with wolves. When Representative Boquist was over on the other side of the hall, we worked with him and others to pass some legislation in 2005. The legislation that came out at that time was a result of the Wolf Advisory Committee that we had formed. We had a 14-member advisory committee that helped us in 2003 through 2004 to put together the document itself. It was a consensus-built document. We had 12 out of the 14 members of the committee signed on to support that, and two members did not that submitted minority reports. But we had three issues that we brought forward to the legislature for consideration changes, again, helping livestock producers give them some additional tools for responding to wolf depredation. That was unsuccessful. After three hearings in the House, we were unable to get that out of committee. We came back in 2006, and we formed again a group of stakeholders, conservation interests and livestock interests, to see if there was some willingness to move forward in the 2007 session with, again, the same things that we offered in 2005 with some different twists to it, if you will. Again, that failed to get out of committee, and we were unable to move that legislation. In 2009, the legislature did pass and change the status of wolves from protected non-game wildlife to a special status game animal. And, Madam Chair, that completes my report, and I'm sure Ron and I will answer any questions.
I have a couple, and I'm looking over there, and Senator Boquist, why don't you go ahead first?
Thank you. Actually, three quick questions. Yes, I think they're quick. Can you speculate or give us some background on where we think the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is on the federal court ruling? Obviously, a judge has made this. What do we anticipate the feds doing at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, our meetings with the service here a couple of weeks ago, they very clearly outlined that they have no federal recovery plan for wolves in Oregon. So they are just a fully listed species with, they do whatever they do. We do have in place some interim strategies for dealing with livestock damage and complaints. However, I have to recognize that unlike Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, which was declared an experimental population even under the federal ESA, Oregon is not part of that designation. We don't have the same flexibility in Oregon as the other states do relative to take of wolves. We're covered under the full authority of the federal ESA. We will work with them on addressing damage. We'll continue to work on our proactive measures, and it will be a cooperative effort, though, between us, Wildlife Services, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But things are more restrictive as when it comes to take under the full force of the federal ESA.
Clarification on that question.
Follow up.
So I think what I hear you're saying is they really don't have a plan right now. Other than the blanket overall law, unlike declaring experimental populations and going down a systematic step-by-step in the other states, there isn't a plan for Oregon at this point. Is that what you just said?
They do not have an official federal plan for Oregon.
Next question, Madam Chair. Just for the record, because we had this discussion during the 2010 session, so I understand scientifically a wolf, which means the difference, what is a wolf and what's not. In previous committee testimony and written testimony, there are really two ways to determine if a wolf is a wolf. First one is the person thinks it's a wolf, so therefore it is a wolf. The second one is comparing that animal to another animal that's been determined to be a wolf. Because remember, we had this discussion last session in the special session. Is there any more science? Have the feds come up with any? There is a DNA that says it's a wolf versus a dog. Or is it really, if an individual thinks it's a wolf and shot it and thought it was a wolf, then it's a wolf. If they thought it was a dog, then we got to compare and find out if it matches some species or some DNA in another state that's been determined is a wolf. You understand where I'm going here, don't you?
Madam Chair. Chair Ray is a member of our commission. I apologize for that. It's just in my brain.
Yeah,
Senator Boquist,
right?
Apologize for that.
We get called different things all the time.
Sorry about that.
You don't look like Marla Ray.
No. Senator Boquist, the response to that is they can trace back a wolf that comes from the original 66 animals that were released in 1995 and 96 to the original origin. They can trace that back many generations back to that original. So that is a possibility. You can take a DNA sample from that, run it through a number of tests, and determine that, yes, indeed, that was indeed from that particular original transplant. There is some efforts right now. I will tell you, this is maybe drifting a little bit, but for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to look at wolves taxonomically in North America, and they've determined there are four subspecies of wolves in North America in different locations. They have a map that has declared what those are.
Follow up. Okay, so previously the agency's position is that it's really difficult. I mean, I was told in writing, which I think both, at least one of you is aware of, that you got to kind of look at the animal and then do some comparison. So what you're saying is since last year, they have now developed a DNA chain, or is it still only fits? Does 100% of a wolf go back to 66, or is it only part of the wolves go back to 66?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, the DNA process has been in place for a number of years. I don't remember recall the correspondence that you're referring to, but you know, our advice to folks is that you better be darn sure what you're aiming at and lethally taking. If you think it's a wolf, you better refrain from shooting that animal. That's our advice to them. It has been very in our synopsis and so on in other direction that we've provided to them, that be very cautious because there are wolves on the landscape. And recently we just had a report of a fellow that was hunting four coyotes in the desert, and he had harvested a number of them, and then he said he saw four wolves. And so he refrained from harvesting those because he knew that these things were different than what he had seen in the past.
Just a point of clarification, Madam Chair. I'd like to send the committee members the previous testimony from Fish and Wildlife, and I'd like Fish and Wildlife to clarify in writing.
Thank you. I'm sure that we'll...
Yeah.
We would. I think it would be good to have clarification because I don't know where the correspondence came from, what biologist or if
well,
it was from...
Madam Chair, it probably came out of me, and basically what... Just to reiterate what Craig said, the only real definitive way is to do the DNA work. You know, if it looks like a wolf, it probably is a wolf, but it's possible for hybrids to be out there on the landscape that you cannot, through the DNA chain, trace back to the wolves released in Idaho, and it just comes back as a dog. It doesn't mean that it's not a wolf that came through the northern Cascades down out of Canada. Just means that they can't, and we couldn't make that genetic link back to what's known to have come out of Idaho.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I just had a couple of quick questions. At this point, thank you, Senator Boquist. We'll look forward to seeing that correspondence. But what's the estimated population right now in Oregon? I heard numbers, you know, the different packs. Do you have it sounds about 20, 25 or?
14.
Madam Chair, we don't know exactly. As a wild animal, you wouldn't know exactly. We know of 17. Let me add them up.
17 and 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 17 adults.
Yeah. And then I would add to that the evidence that we've seen in the Cascades, there's at least two or three possibly animals there. We get reports, what we consider pretty good reports of animals. To answer your question, I'm saying in the range of 30 to 40 animals.
Statewide?
Yes.
And then could you just talk a little bit, I think I'd heard you mention, but about you had a full-time ranger out in Northeast Oregon this summer. I know I was hearing a bit about it. And can you talk a little bit about that program and how that was working? I was actually in Northeast Oregon in the backcountry this summer in the Imnaha region and was hearing about that and talking to some of the locals. So I'd like to hear your perspective on that program and how you think that's been working.
Madam Chair,
to the committee members.
It's they call the Range Rider program, and what we did was we hired a local cowboy, and he works actually for a rancher in Black County, and he bills us as the agency for the payment of that. Of that cowboy, and he spends at least 4 to 5 days a week. He has a number of different horses that he uses and a couple of dogs that he takes with him. And we have coupled with that is we have also another seasonal employee that monitors those wolves in the evening and at night. And he and Jason correspond basically every morning, and he lets him know where the wolves have been and the activities that they've been so that he can go, Jason, and can inspect that particular area. To determine if there's been any depredations, got cows bawling or cows are acting funny, so he can see if there's any problems with that. That our money extended that position for approximately 2 months, and then Defenders of Wildlife have picked that funding up. He is on Defenders of Wildlife funds at this point, and they're going to continue that out through the end of the grazing season. It's one of the preventative kinds of measures that are laid out in the plan that we hope will help the livestock industry prevent wolf depredations on their livestock. We think it's been a great program, and I think the ranchers would agree with that.
And at this point, Madam Chair, he's working primarily on public lands and the public land grazing allotments where the cattle are turned out.
That was going to be my next question. Is where I know that there's a lot of federal land out there. So, but I wasn't sure if it was also tracking in private lands as well.
Madam Chair, yes, he will do that if it's needed or necessary. And there are some private lands scattered in amongst the federal. But for the most part, he's working on federal lands. In fact, he's staying in a Forest Service cabin on Forest Service land. Okay. One thing I might add that one of the ranchers. Did up there, which he deployed, I think, 200 bells on his cows and calves, so you can hear these bells ringing out in the woods in hopes of deterring some of the livestock depredation. Until they start gathering in the fall, we won't know if the wolves indeed have preyed upon livestock and to see how many calves have been missing. But at this point, the range rider has not discovered any.
And the bell technique, Madam Chair, was something that this particular person had learned through his Peace Corps work in Mongolia, mm-hmm. where he'd worked with range improvement programs, and they were dealing with livestock and wolves, and it was something that they used mm-hmm. there as a deterrent.
Last question about collaring and what percentage. I was, again, reading information about this summer, and are pretty much, you know, I know you only have estimates at this point on the population, but what, as far as with the pups, like at what point do you actually collar all of the wolves? I know we have the predominantly most of the adults.
Madam Chair, the plan described there, we would try to collar both the alphas, alpha male and female, in each of the pack. We have done that successfully in the Mnaha pack. We just have one collar deployed in the Wanaha. And this winter, when animals are on snow, we'll probably try to go in with the helicopter and attach more collars to those. The plan says try to collar a member in each pack, but the focus is the alphas because they are the ones that are controlling what the pack does on a daily basis.
Okay. And could you make sure and please send us, or send Beth, and she'll get it out to the members, the draft plan. Right now it's still in draft, and then it's going in front of the commission next month. Is that correct?
It's going in the commission on the 30th. So it
is this month?
Yes, it is available.
So we'll make sure and get the link mm-hmm. out to the members so they can read those specific comments. I'm assuming that's all posted.
Yes, it is posted on our website.
Okay, and I encourage, if you're interested in this issue, obviously at this point it's back in the federal regulators' hands, but certainly we will continue to track this issue. And at this point, I'm assuming you're working closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Is there going to be any type of formal review again of our plan, given the relisting status?
Madam Chair, the relisting status happened in time that we could take that into account as part of our planning process. And you know, actually, we had a fairly frank conversation with the service and our plan and using it as a model for a delisting. When they said that there is no formal plan for delisting in Oregon or recovery in Oregon, I expressed a lot of dismay about that. I said, our goal is to have wolves delisted in Oregon so the state can manage them. And they acknowledged that. Now, what that means, where they'll need to go, we're not 100% sure, but they do like our plan. They support what is written into the plan, and we'll use that for implementation of the federal ESA. And our goal would be to get them to accept our plan as a way to move towards a delisting in Oregon.
All right, thank you. Any other
comments? Just a comment, Madam Chair. Yeah. And we might, as committee members, want to go back. I mean, not having a plan is not a good idea. Whether I hate the plan or not is a different subject. But it might be in the committee's discussion at a later point, sooner or not later, to maybe be in touch with Fish and Wild or a congressional delegation and say, hey, you guys bought this off again. You need to have a plan.
I've already made that note, but I'm glad to see we're thinking on the same lines. Thank you.
And I'm sure Paul Henson, the state director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would be more than willing to mm-hmm. Have him or his staff come down here and talk to you.
Yeah, well, I know for right now our December agenda is fairly packed, but for in next session, because you know, I've been working on the sage grouse issue, and even though that's not listed, I've been impressed about the coordination on that issue, and it seems like there's actually more coordination among the western states than there is right now on with the wolf issue. And I think it would be beneficial to have discussions for us to have discussions with the congressional delegation, U.S. Fish, just so we make sure we're going in the right direction and not spending our resources and then having the feds come back and say, nope, you know, back to square one and need to redo this.
All of the states on wolves are in alignment. They want them delisted. They want them under state control and management authority, and whatever it takes to do that. We're all pretty frustrated with the continued legal processes that results in a relisting.
Right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate the update. Thank you for coming out all this way. Okay, so we'll certainly be hearing more about that issue, especially as the session proceeds.
Representative Levin is not here.
Okay.
You can go forward without him, or you can skip to.
Right. Yeah. So we're actually just a little bit behind schedule here, but I did want to mention that the whole gate channel update actually is going to be postponed because the director is ill, so he couldn't be here. Representative Roblin is not here yet, so we're actually going to move on to our next topic, which is shipping transport of aquatic species, the task force report. So do we have somebody from DEQ here?
Okay.
As you can see, we have a lot of issues that we're covering today, but we have a lot of topics that are
issue per diem worth out of us.
Yeah, that our committee. All right, Representative Roland, well, why don't you come up? Because we were just going to move on to the next one, but there's a lot of overlap. So we'll have Representative Roland talk about the Nearshore Research Task Force, and then dovetail into aquatic species.
Both of which are really good issues.
Exactly. We're covering them all today. You just missed wolves.
I watched on TV.
Okay.
That's why I was here.
Okay. Excellent.
But I got waylaid right outside the door by a few people. So.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you being here today.
So, Arne Roblin, for the record, House District 9, State Representative. And it is really a pleasure for me, actually a real pleasure to sit next to one of the, I think, premier scientists in the state of Oregon. And Dr. Brandt was gracious enough to be a part of the Nearshore Research Task Force and then was elected as the chair. And so he's going to talk a lot more about that process. I just want to talk a little bit about how we got here from my perspective. From my very first election, this has been an issue for me. And I have been one of the people who says it's difficult for policymakers to make good decisions about the use of areas like the Nearshore without the information necessary to make good decisions. And the only way to do that is to figure out how do we get scientific information that we can rely on and trust to inform us as policymakers about how to make those decisions. And we have had that conflict in this body since I've been here, all 6 years. People like this research, don't like that research, believe this, don't believe that. And so my thought was, how do we get an institution, a place, a thing, a whatever, that the science that comes out of it is something that can be trusted? And so my first two sessions, I tried to figure out making that bill. And I talked to different people, and I found out that there were a lot of different stakeholders that really wanted to have a say in that, and it was difficult to get anywhere. So this last time, we produced the way Oregon does it, and I think it finally came to me that really what Oregon does best is bring together constituents and people, and they get them in a room, and they start talking to each other, and out of that flows the best solutions in the long run. And that's what happened with this bill. I was honored to be able to talk at the first group and went to a couple of the meetings. These were dedicated people, and you'll see later a list of all of the people who participated. They are a very big cross-section of the users and other people that care about our Nearshore, including the scientists and the state people as well as constituents. And from that, what I was amazed at is that they came to some really, I believe, strong recommendations about how we can move forward to get that science that we all can trust based on the real scientific method, you know, replicable information, information that is open to everyone to see, so very transparent, so other people can go back and look at it and figure out if they want to do it. And an organization, and they'll talk more about that, that is based on already structures we have here, but with some augmentation to make them even better. And so all of those recommendations come to you unanimously, but one, I think. There was one abstention, so there was no votes against any of the recommendations. But it was great for me to see how that work can be done. It was really impressive to watch Dr. Brandt work with this cross-section of people, and when the Coastal Caucus would stick their nose into it, which we did from time to time, he was willing to stand there and take the, whether it was criticism or whatever, and then look at that as an opportunity to make the process better and work. And I think from the perspective of
this Coastal Caucus member, and I believe the others, rose to the occasion every time when asked to explain why it was going and where the process was going, and that are they making sure that they get the input from all of the constituents. I think he did that well, and I appreciate the recommendations, and we'll let them talk about those. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brandt. And just for members, I'm sure you've figured out this is the marine portion of our agenda, so we're going to be hearing the next three items are actually all interrelated, if you haven't figured it out, and do appreciate all the hard work and leadership that you've shown, Representative Roblin, and because many of this wouldn't have happened without your leadership, so thank you.
And just one last thing, since I am going to leave and not be able to stay for the next one, the invasive species, the workshop that we did there with the transport of invasive species also was one where the stakeholders were all involved, and I did a lot of that one by phone. Again, impressive with the people who are going to be presenting today in the fact that they wanted to make sure that they got all the information they could from all the different stakeholders to make the best possible decisions. And I'm really impressed with that work, too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thanks for your invitation and providing me the opportunity to present the recommendations of our task force. For the record, I'm Stephen Brandt. I'm a professor at Oregon State University and director of the Oregon Sea Grant Program, but I'm here today to tell you, give you a brief overview of what our recommendations were and how we actually operated as a task force. You have in front of you the full report that the task force submitted as a written testimony. I also want to thank Representative Roland for his kind remarks. The task force itself had 14 members, and there were 7 members listed here as from the agencies and institutions, and 7 members from various interest groups. I can support what Representative Roblin said. These members were very active. They were all fully engaged in all of the meetings. We had a very rigorous process. They all had a wide range of expertise and clearly a wide range of interests. And we did all come to consensus and actual almost unanimity on all of the recommendations. The task force overall rationale was to provide a framework to allow trusted scientific information to inform policy and management of the near shore. Part of the responsibility for doing that was to look at how do you obtain unbiased scientific advice that has the public confidence. Secondly, how do you prioritize and coordinate research and monitoring within the state related to nearshore issues? And how do you develop a system where there's sufficient checks and balances throughout the process with extensive public input? That was our challenge. The way we operated is we did work by consensus, and as Representative Roblin said, all of our recommendations had unanimous support, except one recommendation had one abstention. We started from the beginning realizing fiscal reality that we wanted to strive for fiscal conservatism. We didn't want to develop a lot of new entities that are going to cost a lot of money. So therefore, our goal was to build upon existing management and research programs and look at how we might tweak those to make them more effective. All of our meetings were open to the public and had an open website and open public comment as well. We were officially formed last year. Our official membership was confirmed in December, and we had 8 meetings, 1 to 2 full days. We had invited guests, panelists, facilitators, 2 contractors. We drafted a number of documents at various stages and had a lot of input from those. We had presentations to the Coastal Caucus at one stage, presentations to OPAC, Ocean Policy Advisory Council, at another stage, and took their input as well and provided our final recommendations as required on August 1st. I'll go through those recommendations very quickly now. One is to develop a multi-year nearshore strategic plan. We need, as a state, to develop the long and short-term needs. We need to identify those. And once we set priorities, which will also allow us to set scientific priorities and scientific priorities with respect to research and monitoring, that will help unify and coordinate our activities in the near shore. It can also provide a basis for leveraging funding and guiding funding allocations so that money will be spent towards what are identified as the priorities within the state. And we also believe it can be used to help guide regional and federal initiatives rather than being responsible responsive to federal and regional initiatives. If we have our own priorities very clearly stated, we'll be able to lead those priorities both at a regional and national level. A graphical way to look at this is to think about that strategic plan, which would be developed by input from decision makers of all kinds, everything from legislative to government to agency and so forth, input from the public and stakeholders, input from the Policy Advisory Council, and input from the Scientific and Technology Advisory Committee. So you'd have science and policy and public and decision maker input in order to develop that strategic plan. In reverse, that strategic plan will then provide strategic or long-term guidance to each of those entities as well in terms of setting their priorities. In order to develop this strategic plan, we needed a work group, so we recommend to develop a simple work group that would have the responsibility and to develop the strategic plan, make sure there's sufficient and public processes for developing that plan, and then once that plan is developed, they would have the responsibility to implement the recommendations in that strategic plan. Another component was to establish the existing Science and Technology Advisory Committee as an independent advisory body with basically greater responsibilities than it has now. The current STAC was created to advise the OPAC in terms of issues that it may need scientific advice on. There was secondary last year a bill passed, HB 3013, that provided an additional responsibility for STAC to advise ODF&W on scientific issues related to marine reserves. What we're proposing is that STAC be given a greater authority to basically be the scientific body that would advise state decision makers at all levels, rather than having to pass a piece of legislation for every new thing that you want STAC to advise. Just make it the formal body for obtaining that independent scientific advice. In order to do that, we've established some ground rules of how STAC would work following the National Academy of Sciences model. The National Academy of Sciences is the accepted scientific body for advice to a federal executive and legislative branch. It would be involved in implementation of the strategic plan, of course, and the scientific components of that, as well as provide scientific advice as needed to state decision makers. To look at this then on how it might work is for the state decision makers, they would get policy advice from OPAC, scientific advice from STAC, and longer-term strategic guidance from this strategic plan. There are three other recommendations, and they're fairly straightforward. One is to ensure that the citizens and communities are fully involved in the processes of the recommendations. There's clear and simple rationale for that. Individuals have a wealth of expertise. That's really the practice of the way our state does business. And also, that engagement ensures that the implementation and acceptance of what goes on beyond that will be accepted by the public and stakeholders. There's also, as required in the legislation, we needed to look at data management, and we're recommending to establish a coordinated data management system under the auspices of the Oregon Coastal Management Program. There's a lot of scientific data out there, and to avoid duplication, to make maximum use of that scientific information, there needs to be some sort of a coordinated data management system. It's the right thing to do in terms of making maximum use of the data we have and making it applied towards the strategic priorities. The last recommendation deals with creating an Ocean Science Trust, which would be a standalone nonprofit 501c3. The mission of that trust would be to support the priorities set forth in the strategic plan. This provides an opportunity for people that either public agencies, or not public agencies, but NGO or private, want to provide funds to help support the mission of the Oregon in terms of near shore mission. A mechanism to do that actually separates the funders from the scientists doing the work, and a mechanism that ensures that that work is applied towards those areas that have been identified by the state as priority areas. And it would follow very rigorous scientific review and competitive processes in terms of how money was allocated. These are the six recommendations. We put them together as a package, because because we believe they are interconnected and that they are a way to provide a real good mechanism for the state to get real scientific advice into its decision-making process. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Branch. I appreciate it. And I'll open up to the panel first and see if there's questions.
Well, not a question, just a comment. I want to congratulate you in doing the work you did. I understand from doing work groups and stuff that sometimes it's like herding cats, and it sounds like you did a very good job of bringing a lot of people together to understand and to come up with consensus, which really will take us a lot further down the road much quicker.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd certainly like to echo that and appreciate your leadership on this. Any questions from this end? Just a quick one, and I know we're going to hear from the Department of Fish and Wildlife update on marine reserves, so I don't want to get too much into it. But did you go into specific issues at all, or you were mainly looking at framework and how you would process? For instance, you know, we have spatial planning going on, marine reserves. Did you do an inventory of all the different processes that are going on simultaneously, and how this group would? I mean, I think it's a good idea to have one central group that's going to be providing that scientific-based information to inform the process, because, as you know, we've had multiple efforts going on simultaneously. Did you talk a little bit about that? And
Of course, in this kind of a diverse group, you cannot avoid talking about priority issues, and we talked about those not to try and set priorities, because now we have set up a process to set priorities, but we talked about those and how they might be used as examples of how this might actually work. And as you know, there's a number of different priorities, from invasive species to marine spatial planning and so forth. We did, and one of our contractors did a study to try and find out how much research money was actually being spent and on what issues that money was being spent on. And it's very difficult to do that, because you're looking at not only state and federal but private sources as well. And we looked at the issues as defined in various, the Territorial Sea Plan, the West Coast Governor's Agreement, and so forth. So we do have that document as an appendix to our report, but we did not go through and discuss which of those should be priorities or so forth. Does that answer?
We'll make sure. I don't think we sent the report to all the committee members, but we'll make sure and send that link. Mm-hmm. I know I've seen it. One last question about the role of the university in this, and obviously you're associated with the university, but is there going to be, as far as research dollars, or is this new 501c3 entity going to be competing with university or research opportunities, or it'll be complementing each other? Can you maybe, was that discussed at all?
Yeah, not so much in the sense that it might be competing, but if there are currently, private funds that want to go in to fund research, that 501c3 would provide an open competitive process for funding that research, and universities and others would be allowed to compete for those funds. We think that provides a much more fair way to distribute funds. I think universities will be pleased with that kind of, or I can speak on myself as a faculty member, that's the kind of process that we're most familiar with and is the most fair, to have a competitive peer review process for allocating funds.
All right. Thank you again, and I know we're going to hear more if you can stick around for these other presentations. Certainly appreciate the work that you've done, and we'll look forward to hearing more about this process and moves forward. And I think it's, given how many efforts we have going on simultaneously at the coast on marine issues, I think it's really a valuable, the timing on this couldn't be better. And I think it's going to be a really valuable organization to help us make sure that we're moving forward with the best available science and coordinating, given especially the limited resources that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll call DEQ back up now that we've sort of set the stage, and we're going to hear an update on invasive aquatic species, the task force report. Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. You've asked us to come and talk about the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force and their recommendations to the legislature. I have with me Ryan Hoof, who is the ballast water coordinator at DEQ, and he's going to go over those recommendations for you. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Hoof from the Ballast Water Program at DEQ, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Task Force on the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species. Due to a scheduling conflict, the chair of this year's task force, Mark Sitzma from Portland State University, was unable to attend and present the results from this year's study in person, but asked that I present on his behalf a letter, which is the second page of the handout that is being circulated right now. I'm not going to read that letter verbatim in the interest of time, but just want to reiterate that the task force recognizes that this upcoming legislative session is going to present many challenges, but they certainly ask for your thoughtful consideration of the findings and recommendations that I'll be presenting for you here today. I've also included in the handout pack a two-sided handout of the general fact sheets describing both the makeup and background of the task force, and on the flip side, you'll find general information about the ballast water program at DEQ itself. The Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force is charged with studying and making recommendations for preventing the introduction of aquatic invasive species from commercial shipping transport activities. This includes ballast water discharge, but also other potential pathways such as biofouling or hull fouling. These are organisms which attach to hard surfaces and can be transported on the vessel itself. The director of DEQ was responsible for appointing members to the task force and sought to achieve an equitable representation from the maritime industry, as well as environmental and academic research communities and representatives from relevant federal and state agencies. In addition, the legislative leadership is responsible for appointing four legislative advisors to the task force, which in 2010 included Representatives Roblin and Witt and Senators Cruz and Verger. In 2009, House Bill 2714, which passed into law, more specifically defined the objectives of this task force to include identifying and recommending sources of funding to support and maintain the ballast water program established by the Oregon Ballast Water Management Act, which is ORS 783.620. Between October of 2009 and May of 2010, the task force met monthly, and the agenda of this year's meetings was largely dominated addressing those funding limitations and challenges faced by DEQ's ballast water program, which is currently supported by general funds at a level of 1 FTE statewide. The DEQ program implements prevention strategies specifically for commercial vessels to protect public health, ecosystem function, and economic viability of our water resources from the impacts of invasive species. The program objectives includes a wide variety of activities, including vessel monitoring and pre-arrival report screening, vessel inspections and compliance verification sampling, policy development, including coordination with other jurisdictions such as our neighboring states, and outreach and technical support services to the maritime industry. The report, which was completed in June of this year, reviewed regulations in other jurisdictions. It analyzed shipping trends and ballast discharge behaviors of vessels coming to our waters, and this is all data collected by DEQ. And the report also discussed various emerging issues and legal uncertainties that continue to create a fairly dynamic policy landscape on this matter. An electronic version of the report is available through DEQ's Land Quality Division website, but since it was about 80 pages, I'm not providing full hard copies of that today, but I did provide an abridged version of the handouts, which I can provide, which includes the executive summary and the legislative recommendation section. I've chosen not to present an extensive amount of the data presented in the report, which really aims to support the importance of ballast water management regulatory oversight at the state or local level, but instead would like to focus on the legislative recommendations section of the report. First, with regards to the budgeting solutions and levels of resources appropriated to the ballast water program, the task force specifically recommends that the legislation establish a new fee for commercial vessels that are regulated by our Ballast Water Management Act. This would be established in order to create essentially a 50-50 public-private cost-share arrangement to support these activities at DEQ, aimed to implement AIS, or invasive species prevention, activities and program administration expenses at DEQ. Second of all, the task force recommends that using the revenue generated from this new fee, that we authorize DEQ an additional half FTE of resources, as well as $35,000 per biennium in supplemental funds to support program goals, services, and activities. I should note that these supplemental funds were also a part of the 2009 task force request, but were not authorized or implemented. The increased resources that have been requested would allow for a significant increase in the rate of vessel boarding and compliance verification sampling that can be done by DEQ staff. Currently, we are boarding and inspecting approximately 3.5% of the vessel arrivals to Oregon ports. With this requested increase in resources, it's projected that we'd be able to board about 12% of the arrivals coming into our ports. It's projected that we'd be able to increase by about 10% DEQ staff coverage for daily monitoring and pre-arrival screening of ballast water report forms. This is more of a real-time activity that's viewed as being a critical function to our prevention strategies, and it's also very important to industry that DEQ do this. It's been found that if there are non-compliant discharge proposals that are discovered after important economic trigger points in the operations of the vessels, that the cost to remedy that can be extremely expensive to vessel operators. So having that real-time pre-arrival screening is important to the industry. And lastly, the necessary supplemental funds that have been requested would support a variety of things, including the purchase of industry data about shipping traffic, vessel owner information that's necessary for enforcement follow-up, also field equipment and laboratory charges for testing ballast water samples, and also would be used as part of the administrative costs to implement this new fee. In addition, the task force identified two other recommendations in the legislative recommendation section of the report. Includes supporting efforts that may increase state resources available for invasive species early detection and rapid response activities. One of the ways this could be accomplished would be to fully fund the Oregon Invasive Species Council Control Fund that was established by the 2009 legislature, but it was established at a much reduced level compared to the original request. A second method for helping the state have resources available to respond to new detections of invasive species may be to pass a legislative resolution to the U.S. Congress in support of Senate Bill 3063, which would provide financial resources to support western states in the event of new detections in their states. In the process of developing these recommendations, I'd like to make a couple comments about how the task force worked. One of the things that the task force spent a fair amount of time on was carefully scrutinizing the ballast water program operations at DEQ to re-examine the program's objectives and goals. Also explored various options for other potential revenue sources before settling on a vessel arrival fee. This included third-party grant funding or limited duration funding, student internships, federal-state partnerships, or collaborations with our neighboring state in Washington, and so forth. But eventually, including most of the industry members on the task force, settled on the idea of a vessel arrival fee. That fee that they settled on was stated as recommended between $68 and $70 is what's stated in the report, and that is per arrival to Oregon waters. In the process of talking about how that fee would be implemented, the task force discussed various other options, such as a sliding scale that might be based upon relative risk of different vessel types, that is the risk that they could be transporting invasive species into our waters. They talked about a multi-tiered system that might be calculated based upon the volume discharged of ballast water and things of that nature, but eventually settled on basically the same model that is established for California's ballast water program, and that is just a flat fee per vessel, regardless of vessel type. I also want to note that there was a substantial amount of industry support for a fee that is modeled after the DEQ oil spill prevention program fee that's already implemented and administered through a third-party industry group, the Portland Merchants Exchange, in terms of the billing and the fee collection. There are currently in development two pending opportunities for the 2011 legislature to act upon these specific task force recommendations, noting that both of these are being currently reviewed by the governor's office. The first is legislative concept 845, which establishes a $70 per arrival fee for vessels that are regulated by our Ballast Water Management Act, and this would go into effect January of 2012. which was also part of the task force recommendations to implement it in 2012, or not any sooner. DEQ estimates that this fee would generate approximately $210,000 per biennium in revenue. That's assuming 1,500 ship arrivals to state waters per year. The revenue collected would be deposited into a newly created ballast water fund, and the funds would be continuously appropriated to DEQ specifically for the ballast water program and invasive species prevention goals. The second opportunity is DEQ Policy Option Package 134, which would authorize DEQ to hire that additional half FTE that was recommended by the task force to support ballast water program objectives. And as I mentioned, this position would facilitate increased vessel inspection rates in particular, greater coverage for monitoring the arrivals and so forth. To summarize, the legislative concept and the policy option package together would allow for a modest increase in program resources at DEQ, but it would certainly in support of the invasive species prevention goals that I've noted, while simultaneously reducing the program's reliance on general fund support. Once fully implemented, DEQ estimates that the general fund dollars allocated to DEQ for this program would decrease by about 20%. On behalf of the task force and DEQ, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present a summary of this 2010 report. The findings and recommendations reflect the hard work and careful deliberations by task force members, and if implemented, would greatly benefit our efforts to protect Oregon waterways and coastal ecosystems from invasive species threats. At this point in time, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great, thank you. Just a quick one. You had mentioned about California, they had a flat fee. Does Washington have a similar program?
They do not, not in terms of a vessel arrival fee at this point in time. I've heard murmurs that they're proposing one for this legislative session upcoming as well, but at this point in time, they're supported by a variety of fees that include boat registration fees, including recreational boaters are helping support the ballast water program, a variety of general fund sources, and some federal fund dollars that get directed through their Department of Fish and Wildlife to support ballast water program activity.
So they have a similar program, but they're funding it?
Funding it somewhat differently right now,
okay.
Correct.
All right, thank you. Questions? Any questions? I thought Senator Haas might have a question about plastic bags.
We'll leave that for another day.
Okay.
He's got the answer to plastic bags.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much. I certainly, I've worked with Professor Sitzma for many, many years, and appreciate all the time and effort that he put into this and make sure that I didn't know he wasn't able to join us, but I've been corresponding with him via email and certainly appreciate all the time and effort he's put into and his leadership in this effort, and certainly we'll look forward to hearing more about it. Sounds like there's going to be some legislation coming forth from the agency follow-up, and also want to thank, of course, all the members who spent, there's a pretty long list, and a lot of people donate a lot of hours to serve on this, so appreciate it. If you're listening or in the audience, all the members of the task force that work together with you on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our last marine piece today is an update on marine reserves, also from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And right now, colleagues, as you can see, we are having a lot of updates. If we're having further action on any of these, we'll have full panels of many, many people.
What are we doing here? This is cutting through streamlining efficiency.
It is. You can see how efficient we are. We've got these themes. And next, we're going to hear about wolves on vessel. No, just
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have here with me Anna Pakenham, who's one of the team members on the Marine Reserves effort from the Marine Resources Program. Before we get started, I did want to let members of the committee know that among the fishing circles, you have a real outstanding hero as your chair. On our intranet, Senator Dingfelder is showcased with a wonderful fall salmon that is pretty close to the size of the senator. I don't know if that's widely known. But,
we got the story on that.
Okay. She's probably been bragging it down.
I said it almost got away. It was this big. And I got the picture to prove it on my phone.
About that wide, in fact.
I know.
Well, the story has it there was someone underneath there hooking the...
cue the salmon, right? So, no, this one was legit. I have it on good information.
Just a catch and release, of course.
No.
We were very pleased that she was able to enjoy one of these very popular fisheries that we have in
this
fall.
This is my lifetime catch, let me
tell you. Anyway, we're here to talk to you about the process that we've been embarking on relative to House Bill 3013 and the Marine Reserves effort. As I mentioned, Anna is going to walk you through the process that we've been to now, and hopefully we'll have a chance for any questions you may have in the past. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to her.
Thank you, Ed. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anna Paganum. I work for ODF&W in the Marine Resources Program, and thank you so much for this opportunity to be in front of you today. So very briefly, the outline for today is just a background on the process. I know you have all been updated before, but just in case you forgot where we are with the Marine Reserves process. Then I will go through the three different types of sites that we have moving forward in the Marine Reserves process, a proposal site, pilot sites, and evaluation sites, and then kind of briefly go into what we're looking forward to into the future. As you all know, Marine Reserves process has been going on in this state for a very long time with various levels of anxiety and ownership, and starting in early of 2008, the governor issued Executive Order 0807 and a letter to OPAC to really set the sideboards for the Marine Reserves process and to alleviate some coastal constituents' concerns. The executive order said that there will be a public nomination process as Marine Reserve sites move forward, and the sideboards on this process would be there would be 9 or fewer sites. The sites that would be moved forward need to be ecologically meaningful, but they also needed to avoid social and economic hardship. And the proposals that came forward from the community that had a lot of stakeholder collaboration, those proposals would be rewarded. So the public submitted 20 different proposals, as you can see here, spanning up and down the coast. From those proposals, there was an agency analysis by the Ocean Resources Agencies and Oregon State Police. And then from this, at the end of 2008, OPAC put forward the following sites. One was an area for a new proposal development. So the proposals that were put forward were basically thrown out, and the International Port of Coos Bay came forward to start that proposal process again with a new community team. We had sites that were the most mature. These were two pilot sites. They had the highest level of collaboration. These were the most developed proposals, and these were moved forward as pilot sites for full implementation. And then these sites for further evaluation that needed a little bit more time to mature, a little bit more communication, a little bit more collaboration. So those are Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua. So that led us through 2008 and brought us into the 2009 legislative session where we had House Bill 3013, which was sponsored by the Oregon Coastal Caucus. And basically the bill said that you shall implement the Marine Reserve's recommendations on those 6 areas. So support the development of a new proposal, go forward and establish, study, monitor, and enforce these pilot sites, and give some further evaluation to these evaluation sites. And they made ODF&W the lead agency on this. And also, the bill required ODF&W to develop a Marine Reserves work plan that would basically outline the process of how it was moving forward and to provide some transparency, provide for public input, and provide for scientific input as well. ODF&W received $1 million of one-time funding through the new CARISA, and also the bill mentioned that other funds, if they were received, had to be consistent with that work plan to allow for more transparency. And then we need to report back to the legislator on or before November 30th of 2010. So this proposal site, again, this is the one that they're developing a new proposal potentially. It's right off of Coos Bay. It's a large swath of area. And they are looking for if in this area, is there a place that a new proposal can be developed? So the process has been outlined, and they're now looking for different scenarios that might be viable as a proposal. The pilot sites, again, are the most mature. We have Otter Rock, north of Newport, and Redfish Rocks, south of Port Orford. These sites have already gone through rulemaking through DSL, Parks, and ODF&W. They have community teams formed, and they've actually expanded their community teams either through working groups or membership to have more of a diverse membership.
These teams have developed management plans, so dealing with socioeconomics, biological enforcement, and outreach, and baseline studies are being conducted right now. And this is a picture of our Port Orford community team. So let me just briefly touch upon the ecological baseline studies and the socioeconomics because it's pretty interesting what's happening. We have oceanographic conditions that are being monitored through moorings at both of the pilot sites, and we're collecting information on habitat and species composition through ROV, video landers, scuba dive teams, and also using the seafloor mapping data that was given funding last session as well. An essential component of our research is doing cooperative research. So we're using local fishing vessels to help deploy our equipment and to participate in our video lander survey, so giving back to that community as well. Socioeconomically, for baseline studies, there was a rapid assessment done, so looking at the logbooks and surveys that were associated with these sites to get a picture of what's happening now. And then this was look was also done on a regional level as well, looking at ecosystem services, so water quality and things that you get from the ecosystem that used to develop a bioeconomic model and develop fishing community profiles. Again, those studies are to form a baseline so that we have information now before prohibitions go into effect in the summer of next year. The rest of the time, I'd like to focus on the evaluation sites. These are some of the most dynamic sites that we have in this process. They're going to undergo the most amount of change and potentially have a recommendation coming up. These sites are at Cape Falcon on the North Coast, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua. The bill said that we had to form community teams with eight different stakeholder groups, from commercial and recreational fishing to conservation, local government. We have 32 members on each community team, and these teams have met since January, 1 to 2 meetings a month. These meetings are 3 to 4 hours, over 4,000 hours of stakeholder time involved and given to this process so far. There's a huge level of commitment and engagement that has happened so far. The sideboards on this process is they're taking the OPAC boundaries that were in the OPAC original proposal process and seeing if these sites are individually collectively large enough to allow scientific benefit evaluation of the benefits and small enough to avoid that social and economic impact. So there's this balancing act that the team needs to do. Are they big enough to be scientifically meaningful but also small enough so that the users in the area are not adversely or significantly adversely impacted? So through this decision, they will hopefully have a recommendation through consensus by the end of October, potentially into November. So far they've familiarized themselves with the site, each other, and the process. They've really gotten to hear each other's perspectives. They've done a lot of information sharing and gathering. They've used existing data that the department and other agencies have been able to provide. They've used each other's local knowledge. Like I said, these people are experts in these areas. They fish here. They live here. They know the site often better than the department does, so they've been able to hear from each other. And then also we've been able to provide them with new data as well, the seafloor mapping data and surveys. And so through this process, they've been able to look at the original boundary and develop different scenarios of what if. So if I move the boundary north or south, how would these two sideboards be affected? So each team developed 3 to 4 scenarios for further information. So what I mean by that is they took, this is just an example of some of the conversations that have been happening. This is Cascade Head, and the map behind the is a habitat map provided by the Goldfinger Lab. So one example is if you look at the Salmon River, there's a small fishing fleet that comes out of here and does salmon and crabbing right out of the mouth. So that's a social impact. So the team is wondering, how do we minimize that so that that group isn't disproportionately impacted? As you're all aware, to the western boundary and Sandy Bottom is a huge resource for the crab fleet. So how do they minimize that type of impact? And as you can see from the map, that the black is rocky habitat. So that's the tip of Sillett's Reef. So that's an ecologically meaningful site. So while we're trying to minimize that social and economic impact, how do we still maintain ecological meaningfulness so that we can actually learn from these sites? So that's the type of balancing act that these teams are really trying to accomplish. And it's a difficult task, and they've been doing a really great job of trying to weigh those things. So not only do we have these community teams, but we've also had a large amount of public input. At every team meeting, there's public comment. We have a bulletin board on our website where the public can submit information for the teams to consider. We also have a public comment period right now on the scenario so that the general public can provide further information. So from these scenarios, our agencies, Parks, DLCD, ODF&W, and OSP are conducting an agency analysis to provide these teams on feedback. And then we're also working with the Science and Technical Advisory Committee, which you heard from Steve and Brent. We've also had a workshop with them on Monday to get the technical experts to help us with this analysis as well. So in the future, we will return this information to the teams on how good the sideboards met that the teams and their scenarios met that balance. And they will finally make a recommendation, hopefully through consensus. We will go back to the Science and Technical Advisory Committee for future input. We'll have another public comment period. We're required to consult with OPAC, and then we will return to the legislator. Again, for the proposal sites, there potentially will be a site recommendation. The pilot sites will continue monitoring and are implementing and monitoring and enforcement with our prohibitions going into effect this summer. And again, we will come back to the legislator. Through this process, we hope to continue our community team engagement in public. People have given an immense amount of time, and we'd like to continue that process. And then we'll have to look at funding sources as well for the next biennium. As I mentioned, the new CARISA was a one-time source, and we'll have to consider a diverse portfolio of funding from federal, potentially state, and private foundations as well. So this is our website, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Just a quick question about the timing for when you think you'll be coming back to the legislature with those further recommendations.
Madam Chair, the intent is to have the teams wrap up late October, early November, allow us to touch bases with the science, independent science groups again, and OPAC. And so we may be considering, depending on the new administration in, there will be part of this within the budget. There's already a placeholder through a policy option package for this plus other nearshore activities that the agency is interested in. And then we would envision, although it's not required by any stretch and there won't be any pre-session filing, but we'd anticipate some semblance of a policy bill to help guide whatever future steps are taken on this effort.
So we are looking at this coming session.
This session, correct.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions? Do you have Coast in your district? Or you don't? Okay, so just Senator Atkinson is no longer with us.
Yeah.
But thank you. I know you've been putting a lot of effort and work into it, and again, all the people that aren't here in this room and hours and hours and hours of dedication that citizens and all the different stakeholders have put into the process. So we appreciate the work that you've been doing to coordinate that effort, and excellent feedback. We'll look forward to hearing more, I'm sure, 2011.
Great. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I will clarify that my district does have, the two counties do have an influence on the coastal, since it actually is not landlocked.
There you go. Well, this isn't just, obviously, if you're only a coastal legislator as well, because it's a resource for the entire state, but yes. Certainly I think it's important that our coastal legislators, and they obviously have been very, very involved in this process, and really appreciate the leadership that the Coastal Caucus has provided also on this issue. And Anna knows, as a former staff person, it's been a really good resource having you continue as leadership part of that process. That continuity, I think, is really important.
Thank you, Senator.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll look forward to hearing from you again, I'm sure, in a few months. Okay, and last but not least, we have a state forester up that's going to speak about the state forest management plans, and I will give a very brief update on Destination Resort Work Group. That'll probably be about a two-minute update, so we may actually get out of here a little early. So you can eat something before your committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'll try to help you achieve that goal. Yes, for me to come and provide a brief update of where we are on the revision of the state forest management plan. So I'll just kind of talk through that and give you the salient points, I think, of what decisions have been made and which ones are yet to come. I'll just start back at when the plan was approved in 2001, there was some fairly explicit assumptions that this plan could yield a very high level of timber production, 289 million feet, nearly an industrial level of timber production, while managing the forest in a way that could achieve about half of the acreage in complex wildlife habitat structure. When we started to implement the plan, it became, pretty apparent to the folks on the ground that those two goals weren't mutually attainable. And we went through several years of discussion with the legislature and with the board, collecting substantial amount more inventory data, improving our analytical models, and coming back with what we thought was a better analysis of what's feasible on those lands. And in the end, we were much more confident saying that if you wanted to achieve an industrial level of timber production on those North Coast lands, I'm talking about specifically the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest, if you wanted to achieve that level of industrial production, really 10% complex wildlife habitat structure was about all that would be feasible. At the same time, if you wanted to stick with the 50% complex habitat structure goal, that you were only going to achieve about half of the timber production. And from that point then, we entered into some lengthy discussions with the board about what they expected in the way of outcomes. That led to some performance measures that started to define their expectations a little better. Their expectations were expressed in those performance measures that they would like to see better revenue performance from the lands, but they wanted to be very cognizant of what the trade-offs might be with the wildlife benefits. And we worked through that for a long time, came up with a proposal that said we could achieve a realistic set of goals on both sides by eliminating one part of the plan that called for a habitat conservation plan, a formal agreement with the federal services, and use a more flexible species of concern approach to dealing with particular wildlife that people felt were at risk, and at the same time lowering the range of complex structure goal from 40% to 60% down to 30% to 50%. In April of 2009, we brought back a report that ODFNW had helped us prepare outlining how we would approach the species of concern strategies. And then in September of 2009, the board approved that we go ahead with formal rulemaking to make those changes. We went through the formal administrative review process to do that, extended the deadline for comment, and in April of 2010, the board adopted those two changes to the plan, and we're in the process now of developing an implementation plans that bring the timber harvest production to about 195 million feet and with a goal of reaching 30% complex habitat structure.
I just have a quick question on that. Given the economic situation, how realistic do you think that is?
So far, we've been able to reasonably meet our timber production goals for a variety of different reasons. We have had right before the recession, we had a number of sales that were bid up pretty high. And we developed a process with some of the purchasers whereby they could delay harvesting those sales by paying 95% of the cost up front and then delaying basically their logging costs and a few things. I think we had about 9 timber sales that asked for those extensions. I'm not sure Nancy's here, but she might correct me. I think 2 of those have been taken off and are active again. There's another 7 that are still in the extension process. But overall, we've been just focused on what kind of wood is selling in this market. It's not the typical Tillamook log, which is smaller, lower quality, But the higher quality, larger logs have generally met with a lot of good bids.
So I interrupted you. I didn't know if you were.
No, that's about all. The board, has had some ongoing discussions about the species of concern strategies, and wanted to make sure we were applying ones that would be the most effective. And we've entered into a contract with the Institute for Natural Resources, and they're reviewing our work there, both from the standpoint of not just biology, but does the strategies that we're proposing really align with the board's overall goals, which is to integrate economic, social, and environmental values into those kinds of decisions. And I believe we expect that report in December back to the board. And what we find from that, we can make modifications to the strategies because they weren't incorporated specifically into the plan. All we did was incorporate into the plan, which is administrative rule, that we were going to deploy these strategies. And the strategies themselves are really under the purview of the state forester.
Okay. Questions? Senator Prasansky?
Marvin, I had a constituent ask me regarding how the bidding process works. I think they may have been talking more about it. I'll just extend this to the state. Because we're in such an economic downturn, do we have minimum bids that are required to for when we put tracks up for harvest sale?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Prozansky, we do. And those are established based on essentially what's happening in the market at the time, what we call pond prices, what seems to be what mills are paying for wood. So we adjust those with the market conditions and set a minimum bid, and that has to be met. And the sales that we've been selling lately, we had a little uptick actually starting about a year ago, and we were actually getting bid ups that were two times the minimum that we were setting, and it was looking pretty good for a while. But we're back down now to where the bids we're getting are pretty close to the minimums that we've set. And just if I could say one more word, one of the analyses that we do when we put a sale out is that it will at least cover the 35% that we retain to do management will cover our costs for administering a sale and reforesting the sale. So when prices get so low that it doesn't, we're going to be losing money to put up a sale, then we'll go look for others. Like I said, we're not focusing on the small diameter Doug fir very much at all right now, unless we're sure we can cover our costs to do that.
Okay. Follow up?
Yeah, follow up. So when I get back to this individual, my response would be that there are minimums.
Yes.
That the price, is it something on the open market for this time, meaning where we're at economics? Because their point is that we may be seeing sales that are much lower overall cost of overall value, and that basically if we held back and sold at a later time, we would get much greater value out of the resources that belong, as they said, to everybody in the state.
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Prozansky, it's a good discussion to have. The piece that we have to factor into there is the other 65% of the revenue that we generate is revenue that the counties use, and so we do feel like it's important to maintain at least some predictable level of cash flow to the counties, even if it would be smart to wait another 2 or 3 years and get back to regular prices. Okay. Of course, there's an economic analysis that would be involved in that decision too, because of the cost of money. You might wait 2 or 3 years and gain 20%, but is 20% really worth that amount of time?
Right. Thanks for the clarification.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, and I know that your chair, I think we invited the chair to be here as well and couldn't be here, so we may want to ask him to come back at a future hearing.
Thanks, Chair. I could say a little bit about where we're headed from here, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, we would like to know about next steps, because we'll either have you come back in December at the beginning of next session.
You know, when the board agreed to proceed with the rulemaking to change the plan, they also asked us to conduct a formal review of the rules that guide the planning process, specifically two parts there. In statute, the mandate for state forests is to achieve the greatest permanent value. And an administrative rule that has been further elaborated on by rules that were adopted back in the, I think, the late 90s. And that rule called for a review of the basic premises, and so that's what we're conducting right now. We assembled a public advisory committee, a very diverse group of folks that provided a lot of extensive feedback to the board on how, if, or if that definition and an administrative rule for greatest permanent value should be revised. The board hasn't acted on anything yet. We haven't brought them a recommendation. We've been talking to them, trying to get their sense, and I'd say I think I'd speak fairly at this point that their sense is they want to maintain a good balance of all the values. There's not, I don't think, going to be a majority of the board decide that we need to emphasize timber over wildlife or wildlife over timber, but that we need to continue on a course that keeps everything at a pretty even balance. The other part of the rule that we're just now starting to explore with them deals with the planning process. And from our standpoint, the department standpoint, and I think several board members, we'd like to make sure that process is efficient and is effective at being able to adapt to make changes as we need to make changes, that it's streamlined and isn't adding any more bureaucratic costs than we need to, and so we're going through that review right now.
All right, just a couple of comments, I appreciate your coming forward, and I know I've been talking to you in between about getting updates for the committee. First of all, if we can get a copy of the INR report when that comes out, if you send that to Beth so we can share it with committee members, if they'd like to review that, I think that would be helpful. Also, I think follow-up to Senator Przanski's comment, I think we want to make sure that we're not, because of this fiscal situation that we're in throughout the whole state, one, that we're not shortchanging our resources because we need the cash now, and making sure we're still making decisions that are sustainable for the long term. And certainly make sure that the state's costs are covered and that we're looking long-term about using these resources wisely. I mean, a concern I have is if the market's down and we're, if we hold on for a few more years and we're going to get a better return, I think that's wise. I realize our obligations to the counties, but I think we also have an important balance that we have to maintain here, and certainly have had lots of discussions with the chair about the greatest permanent value rule, and was involved in the 90s in a lot of those hearings, so I'm very familiar with that discussion. Certainly, it would be prudent, I think, to keep this committee informed as the board continues their discussions, and I'm glad to see that you have convened an outside policy group to also advise the commission. I think that's helpful, and I have been kept abreast of those meetings, so I appreciate that. So with that, I think if you can continue to provide information through Beth, make sure the committee members get it, and we'll have an update either in December when our next interim or our last interim hearings. Actually, I think we also have January meetings as well, and then when session starts. So appreciate that, and if you can just mention to the chair that if hopefully he can be here at the next one, that would be helpful as well.
I'll do that for sure.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And finally, committee members, just to provide a quick update on the Destination Resort Work Group. That's been a work group. We have a couple of members here in the audience that been working with me and Beth over the past year. This is a follow-up to the legislation that was passed in February, and we're continuing those discussions. There will be legislation submitted. We're going to put in placeholder legislation while we're continuing to finalize legislation for the 2011 session. But this meeting has been going very well. I want to thank, again, the hard work and many, many, many hours that staff has put into it and all the members. And so appreciate your input. We're in the process right now of finalizing some draft language, so hopefully in the December meeting we'll have more details that we can provide, but we're going to continue working on that. Certainly am hopeful that we'll be able to find bill language that we can agree on, and we're certainly working towards that goal. So that's pretty much most of the update that I can provide at this point, but stay tuned because we'll be bringing something forth in December, and I'll be asking members of the work group probably to come forward at that time as well. So with that, we're a little bit ahead schedule. It's amazing. And appreciate the few that are left, and we'll be returning in December for future informational hearings. With that, I will adjourn the Senate interim.